Today's show is brought to you by Bombfell. For $25 off your first purchase, visit bombfell.com/GOT.
Today's podcast is also sponsored by Sonos, home theater for music lovers. For the first time ever, Sonos is offering listeners of the Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only, cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Use the promo code GOT10, that's capital G, capital O, capital T, 10, at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 7, titled The Dragon and the Wolf. It's the season finale of the penultimate season. What'd you think of it on the second viewing?
I liked it. I still think Theon getting kicked in the crotch being his magic power is dumb. But honestly, I think I actually watched this a couple more times, and I think the Sans and Arya stuff has a pretty clear through line that a lot of people are not seeing or choosing not to see that I'd like to break down when we get to it.
Okay.
There's like a lot of different ways you could explain their interactions, but I think there's one that's kind of like, you know, comes out of a close watching. But everything else, yeah, I think it was a bumpy road to get here. It can be argued that there is a better way to get to this viewpoint. I also don't know what it's like to work under the budgetary and time constraints that the Double Ds work under. So for me, this got me immediately re-excited for Season 8. And that's what I think a finale is supposed to do.
Sure. Yeah, after second viewing, I think it holds up just as well as the hype that I felt after the first viewing. I see very few problems. Like, if you ignore the problems kind of with the setup from the last couple episodes, I see very few problems with this episode. And I thoroughly enjoyed it on the second viewing.
It seems like a lot of the discontent. I mean, there's a lot of leftover, like, well, this is just the continuing dumbed-downification of Game of Thrones.
I thought it was a return to form, honestly.
Yeah, but people are like, oh, how is Littlefinger going to go out like that? Or, you know.
Go out like what? His own schemes coming back to haunt him?
People are, I think, going down the conspiracy wagon a little too far. I saw a lot of threads saying that, oh, Tyrion's a turncoat and here's the proof. Or, you know, Tyrion's going to betray Dany because he was making a frowny face outside the bedroom. I don't think those are necessarily stupid. I think there are things you can get from watching an episode, but I also don't think they're what is the plain reading of the plot. And I feel like sometimes the fan base gets themselves worked up about that kind of things. Like, they see a little thread to pull, and God knows there's so many threads you can pull in Martin's works, and they start pulling on it, and they're like, oh, look, I've knitted this whole sweater out of this thread. And then at the end, when George or the Double Ds are like, oh, actually, we weren't intending to knit that sweater, they get mad. Like Preston Jacobs, I think colored a lot of his coverage because he had convinced himself that, you know, R plus L equals J was just a sleight of hand diversion to cover up the real truth. And then it's like, I'm like, no, man, you just huffed a bit too much paint and got a little too far up your own theories, and now you're mad because that it didn't turn out to be that way. It's like, so it's tough. And, you know, there's also not a wrong way to watch
from,
this
like,
show,
a,
you know?
From a pure viewer perspective, I don't think it's tough. I think you can sit back and you can enjoy this episode all day long.
But it's
like,
happened
this is
us,
a great
right?
episode
like,
of Game
like
of Thrones.
I've definitely seen where
For sure.
And I have gotten, you know, like the wrong idea about a work, and it's affected it. Like Mr. Robot, like there were some goings in Westworld where, like, if our, you know, the state of our biological computer fucked up, I think, the enjoyment of the arts. It can happen, and I see it with 100 million people watching this thing around the world. It's certainly going to happen. So I just want to say, I'm just saying a cautionary tale for those people that are like really investing into the super secret hidden truth behind Game of Thrones Season 7, and maybe pump the brakes and be open that it's not going to be that.
I'm open, man. I'm wide open. I love this episode.
Yeah, yeah. So do you want to get right to it?
Hey, I want to take a brief break to talk about stuff that's going on baldmove.com or stuff you might have missed last week. We had a social media, our Empire Business series for club members, where we go in the behind the scenes of a podcast startup. We talked about our social media strategy with our social media manager, Sandra, who's been helping us behind the scenes, piecing that stuff together. We also did a podcast with me, Cecily, and Jim, where we talked about on Bald Move TV, a separate feed, talked about Rick and Morty, Ozark, the new season of Defenders, or I guess the first season of Defenders on Netflix, and Glow, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. If you're interested in any of those topics, you can check it out. And then I think Jim's got a special offer he wants to talk about.
Yeah, I'm doing something called the Game of Thrones Pod Pack, and it's basically a charity event that's going to support the ACLU. I think a lot of people who identify with some of the heroes and characters in Game of Thrones understand the importance of an organization like the ACLU, and so I've got 10...
Let's say you're Littlefinger, yeah, and you're civil right. You're being wrongly executed on the testimony of some
of
psychic
witch.
Child.
A witch. Yeah, let's call him
Do
a
you
witch.
Want the WCLU to come in there and like put the legal smackdown?
I do.
And file an injunction and counter-suicide? You probably do, right?
Yeah.
You want someone watching over your back like that.
And I still want Littlefinger to lose that battle, but I want him to have due process.
Do it right. Yeah. This is the only way you have justice in the world is if you make it yourself, Sansa.
Right. So to that end, I've put together a group of 10 Game of Thrones podcasters, and we've all produced a special episode of our podcast. It's not just talking about the season. Some people are playing Game of Thrones-related games. Some people are doing deep dives on particular subjects, like Aaron, myself, did. Aaron, you talked about the Doom of Valyria in your podcast, or in our podcast. Mm-hmm. And I talked about the religions of Westeros and how they relate to the story. You can go to podpack.baldmove.com to get the link to get linked over to the project. And any amount you can help support, it's $9 for 10 podcasts. It's fairly cheap, but there are also other levels. And if you want to give a little extra, you can. If you want to get all 10 podcasts and feel like you're doing good things both for the ACLU and the country and also the podcasters, because they're getting a portion of the proceeds as well.
Give me a sampling of who's participated. It's Bald Move.
It's Cast Bald of Move. Kings. We've got Cast of Kings. We got Pot of Thrones. We got a cast, what is it? A Storm of Spoilers.
Yep.
It's Joanna Robinson's spoiler podcast. Just a whole bunch of people. Jay and Jack, who were kind of my podcasting idols.
I didn't know you got them.
Yeah.
This is all essentially what you've been doing while I've been slaving after Game of Thrones.
Right. I've been putting this whole project together, and you've been doing feedback nonstop. So,
yeah.
I think it's a really cool thing, and it goes to help a lot of people, you know, who are affected by the various issues that the ACLU supports.
ACLU did a good job of kind of clearing all the copyright bullshit from the podcasting itself, because there was a patent troll trying to essentially assert rights of distributing podcasts in some sort of organized format.
Yeah.
And they were instrumental in defeating that copyright claim. So.
Yeah, I mean, they're about like freedom of speech and a lot of other rights that, you know, are hand-in-hand with what America
freedom
is.
Freedom to not being accused by a witch.
Right.
On pain of death.
Yeah. So go check that out if you want to. Podpack.baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Yeah, sure. Let's start off with Danny's army congregating at King's Landing for their meeting with Cersei. Bronn and Jaime are talking about the Cockless. Tyrion remarks about the million or so people living in King's Landing and the quality of the brothels.
Would you say that Bronn would stock 500 barrels and then Bronn would stock 500 more?
At least, yeah.
Just to be the man that pours that boiling pitch upon Danny's armies forevermore.
Far too elaborate of a joke. of a setup for the joke you're going for. Uh-huh. Yes, I would say he would.
All right.
He would stock 500 and 500 more. And the Hound pokes at the white down in the hold of the ship, I guess. I really liked seeing the Unsullied in attack formation. I knew the attack wasn't coming here, but it got me pumped anyway for an inevitable battle that we're going to see.
Yeah.
And you know, there are some things that I expected were going to happen, and they kind of set up in previous episodes that didn't happen, mm-hmm. like logistical challenges of getting the Unsullied from Casterly Rock to King's Landing and making that, you know, a plot point, because right. they did, right? They essentially said, yeah, they're all the way on the other side of the freaking planet at this point.
Right.
So they kind of just skip over that, and I'm okay with it. I don't know. A lot of people probably had a problem with it.
Did you think there was a little bit of a baby bump with Cersei going on? Because as I was watching, I thought that maybe they're trying to suggest that. Because all joking about jetpacks aside, it would take a not inconsiderable amount of time to march mm-hmm. from Casterly Rock to King's Landing. But I kind of got the idea that, you know, maybe 6 weeks or so. And I don't know if that's enough time to march an army and provision them and all that stuff when there's food scarce in a realm. But,
right.
I mean, it's certainly not the most egregious case. And, you know, it took a while for Dan. I don't know. It's like either going to accept it or not.
It took a while to get this white.
Yeah.
It took a while to get all her troops down to King's Landing after it.
Right.
Yeah. I think the timing could line up. They just didn't show it to us, which is fine.
Right.
I really like this conversation between Braun and Jamie
about
the cockless.
It's essentially, it's cocks all the way down. Yeah.
Maybe it's all cocks in the end.
You know what? A shocking amount of the world is about cocks. Like, yeah. Sex, yeah. Sex does at a very root primal level run the world and explain a lot of noble and horrific behavior.
Yeah. And in as much as we have a patriarchy now, it was certainly worse back then.
Sure,
and the cock could be the symbol for essentially humanity at that point.
Right, right. And as women, become a bigger part of society and civilization, I think we find out that clits can rule the world too. A lot of people. I mean, it's a biological imperative. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
I also really like the Jaime. Like, there's so much good character work where he's like, oh, yeah, Tyrion, always a champion to downtrodden. But the way he says it, you can even tell it's like he intends it as a put down, but there's also a little bit of admiration there.
Yeah.
And, like, he comes about it fairly. And I liked, the essential, like, rural versus urban divide of John, like, a million people stacked on each other's ass. Why would you live that way?
Sounds like hell.
and Tyrion's like, well, number one, there's people like me who would kill themselves if they were stuck in Winterfell for all their life.
With poor
and also,
quality brothels.
There's a lot of people that don't want to live this way, but there's not enough jobs. Like, how many fucking woodcutters and blacksmiths and shit do you need in Winterfell anyway?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you got to go to the streets of steel to peddle your wares. So I thought that was interesting. That's like it's so indicative of so many problems that we have today in the United States and probably around the world, that like you cannot imagine another way to live other than the one that you've always lived.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually even for a guy like John, it's hard for him to stretch his mind that way.
The other thing that we can note here is there was no magic that stopped the white from coming south beyond the wall. It's alive and well in that case, and it continues to be so.
So one could surmise that the dead cannot under their own power cross such a boundary. But...
Or that Benjen is full of shit.
Well, I mean, we've seen whites disintegrate upon a
not at the wall, though.
Not at the wall.
Yeah.
Not at the wall. But, I think... The Night King had to obliterate the wall across it, so like I don't think that's nothing. Because if it's just a physical barrier, do you really think those whites couldn't climb it?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's a surmise.
I would assume it could. I would assume they could, but
right, right.
Yeah, definitely the magic is not a thing that they need to worry about up at the wall.
Well, now it isn't, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. There's a really quick scene here, and I think you were alluding to this earlier, where Cersei tells the Mountain to kill her enemies in a very specific order if anything goes wrong, essentially Dany, Tyrion, and then the others. Then Bronn meets Jon's group and on the road and escorts them to the meeting location, which are the dragon pits. Brienne and the Hound talk about Arya briefly. Tyrion reiterates his offer to pay Bronn double for his loyalty, and Bronn... I don't know, just states how he's looking out for himself, his own interests, by bringing two traitors to Cersei. I really am loving the reunions in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to see Pod and Tyrion back together.
Yeah.
It's good to see Bronn and Tyrion back together, and I like how, Tyrion's like, I have missed you. When Bronn essentially gets the best of him in this conversation, right, and makes his point. I guess Bronn's sort of reluctant to say, yeah, it's good to be back, buddy, but
right.
I don't know. I feel like that's very much within Bronn's character.
Well, also, I think you say that he won the conversation. I don't know. I think Tyrion stroke a pretty good wound here, and also the fact that at the end of this episode, Jaime abandons this other queen. At what point does Bronn start to see that the grass is greener on the other side? Like, both of my champions are now on the other side now. Is Cersei... Do I trust Cersei to give me castles and gold when I've seen how she treats me? It's like, no. So I think that this was an opening that Tyrion exploited, and it's going to pay off perhaps next season.
Yeah, I always, I guess, have faith in Bronn's ability to pivot, though. So it's like, yeah, in this moment, sure, he might be backing the wrong side in the long run, but... He also is doing the thing he needs to do right now to get by and to get a leg up, you know?
Right. Like, I mean, in any way this goes down, he probably profits from it.
I certainly believe he could go to Tyrion and say, hey, Tyrion, how about that offer?
Yeah, no,
like,
sure.
If this doesn't go his way.
Yeah, because he does have a valuable skill set
that
could be put to use. So I also like the setting and the fact that, like, they did a lot of world building and, like, lore dumping with the dragon pit where, you know, a lot of stuff that they kind of hinted about the dragons being confined here and the problem with having dragons. Like, you've got these big battle dragons just flying around King's Landing as it became a prosperous hub that, you know, the Targaryens faced a lot of pressure to, you know, enslave their dragons essentially and lock them away, and that has diminished them as a people and as a military power. Mm-hmm. And that fact that, like, that they were these mortal enemies are meeting, as Tyrion points out, at one of the most dangerous places in the world 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And the dueling trust involved, and, like, you can tell, like, when Bronn marches up with his, you know, like, they're sizing each other up, like, could we take these guys if we had to? Mm-hmm. Like, we're really in the belly of the beast here. I thought it was great. I thought Brienne and the Hound talking about Arya.
Speaking real quick of the belly of the beast, where is the dragon pit?
It's kind of like it's just ruins on this the outskirts. It's within the, if I'm correct, and I don't know because it kind of caught me flat-footed. I believe it's within the walls of King's Landing, but it's fallen into disrepair and ruin. Like, it used to be like an arched dome.
Yeah, yeah.
That can obviously to contain the dragons, and now it no longer is.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was a little silly that there'd still be dragon bones there.
You think so?
Like, come on. You don't think that some peasant has picked through every last dragon bone and any bone fragment and sold it for, like, you know, a souvenir or something by now?
Or, like, put it into a soup or ground it into dust and sold it on the black market?
Exactly. Like, you know, we...
Virility serum.
That's what I'm saying. if we drink... If there's people here on this planet to drink bear bile and eat
snort tiger penis,
cock, then they're for sure dragon bones are going to do something to your penis.
For sure. And
it's
all
cocks all the way down. Yeah, all right. So, but Brienne and the Hound being almost like these proud surrogate parents of Arya.
Yeah.
And I like it. Yeah, and, like, you know, if no one, the only person in danger is people to get in her way, and he's like, well, it won't be me. Like, that was good. That was a good scene.
Yeah, the Hound has kind of come to terms with some of his emotions, you know, not just his ability to kill people.
And it mirrors that with Arya, too, the fact that, like, the scene last year where she's talking about how she still wants to kill Sandor and, you know, Jack and slaps her for telling a lie. Like, these have all kind of mirrored each other, and it's paying off here.
For sure. So they arrive at the meeting location and Cersei shows up. She's mad that Dany's late until Dany rides in on her dragon.
We skipped in the fact that, like, we didn't get the Clegane Bowl, but we got the weigh-in.
Yeah, we're about to get to it.
Oh, I thought the Dany makes an interest after Sandor goes and says a shit to his brother.
Maybe so. I mean, this is the whole scene, right?
Okay. Like,
them arriving and Cersei showing up. And then Tyrion starts to speak. I'm going to do a lot here. So
that's
we're gonna
what
have
I'm
a lot
worried
to talk
about. I'm worried about missing stuff.
I'm going to do this whole scene because that's how I do it.
All right.
Tyrion starts to speak. He's cut off by Euron, who tells Theon, hey, I'm going to kill Yara if you don't submit to me right now. Everyone says, shut the fuck up and sit down, Euron. And then Tyrion pleads their case. After some explanation about the northern threat, Jon says, we've got something to show you. And they bring out the White. Euron's scared shitless, and he decides to take the fleet back to the Iron Islands and wait out the winter. Cersei agrees to the truce as long as Jon makes an oath not to fight in Dany's war. Unfortunately, he's a Stark, and he can't do that because he's already made an oath to Dany and pledged himself to her. So Cersei storms off. Everyone's pissed at Jon, and Tyrion says, I'll go talk to my sister.
Right.
A lot of shit happened in that scene.
Yeah. So, like I said, you get the Clegane Bowl weigh-in where, you know, essentially it's like the boxers meet and they put their fists up and, like, you know, it's like, ooh, everybody get excited. There's no love lost between these two. And then Dany making her interest with the dragons was fucking epic.
This whole meeting is so fucking good because it's so tense, right? Yeah. You don't know, like, as they're walking in and you don't see Cersei around and this is, like, a foreign land and they know it could be a trap. They could all just get blown up here with wildfire.
And
they're thinking that. It's going through the head.
And on the other side, Dany could come in and with one breath of Drogon fucking end this war in its entirety.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's super tense, and I think it's awesome.
Yeah, and I just loved, like, the I cannot believe how they shit the bed on Danny mounting Drogon to fly out of the fighting pits of Meereen, and mm-hmm. then they can pull off a scene like this where, like, everything worked, like the mocap and her, like, the fact that Drogon, like, just, like, I thought it was just such a cool thing how low he got to the ground, like how much effort this dragon took to scrape before to make sure that she didn't even have to work to get down. Like, like they just show with wordlessly how under control these dragons were as opposed to two seasons ago. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, it's like I said, a lot of times with watching the show, my head and my guts get into a fight because my head's like, and my gut's like, yeah.
Right.
And I just feel like that, like, my head says, like, maybe I wish that I'd known a little bit more about how she actually got this control of the dragons. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just, oh, some mystical connection they have. But they sold it, and I'm buying.
Yeah.
Were you afraid that the whole Michigan J frog theory of the white just not working when it got to King's Landing was going, like,
with how long they took for the reveal?
They were totally baiting us on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought, because I was just about to laugh, like, oh my God, the Night King is having a good old time cutting strings to the puppet, and it's just going, his rotting corpse, and like, and then what the hell is going to happen?
Yeah.
But then when it came out, it was so ferocious, and with Cersei's backstory and the fact that she's pregnant now, like that. You know, I scratched my head about, like, why the fuck is Cersei pregnant? But that little detail sold me on all the machinations that they have to do the rest of this plot.
Right.
Because they have made that a consistent point that Cersei, she got good cheekbones, she loves her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So and now that this is the future of her dynasty, like, I totally bought everything. Like, all the reversals, all the false starts, all that stuff, because they established that fact. So kudos, because I know that was, you know, people kind of derided that, like, oh, out of nowhere, Cersei's pregnant. Turns out it's pretty vital to the plot.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on here that on first viewing, when you don't understand that this is a switcheroo and a ruse, it doesn't make a ton of sense, or it's like, yeah, okay, I see what they were doing there, but also, like, when you know what's happening, it makes it so much cooler. Like Euron, right? Like, I could totally see a guy like Euron saying, you know what, fuck this. I'm out. Yeah, I don't need any of this. I'm going to wait you all out.
I'm going to, after winter,
I wonder how well that works when your island's made of fucking rocks and you have no food for an indeterminable amount of time as you wait out the winter.
Right.
Could be 10 years, could be 100 years. Who knows?
Right.
But then it becomes so much deeper, right, when you realize that this is part of the plan.
Right.
And a lot of people are asking, like, oh, how the hell could it be part of the plan? They had no idea that there was going to be a white here.
I don't know that's true.
Okay, A, it might not be true.
Because
there's
been a through point this whole season about, like, how the fuck does Cersei keep knowing all these things that she shouldn't be able to know? And I do think that there is a strong possibility that there is a betrayer, or at least a double agent on Danny's side.
Possible. Yeah.
And that, so, but
it'd be hilarious if it was Jorah.
He came
again,
back.
Again, right, Jorah, right, with the betrayals.
On, come on. You know, Cersei's, yeah, it's, come on. You don't need Cersei's pardon now. You've got the queen and her dragons.
Right.
So that's one. That's one possibility, but I think you're about to articulate the other.
The other is that this is a general idea that they have, and that Euron seizes upon this moment, this opportunity to say, okay, I'm gonna execute the plan that we said, which is to basically show that we're not unified in any kind of way,
right?
You know, and I think it's a great juxtaposition between the unity that Dany and her crew are showing,
right,
and the disorganization and lack of unity that Cersei.
And if you keep that thought going, like, the fact that Euron was so belligerent at the beginning is all part of the part he was playing, because he is setting up this bullshit rift between him and Cersei so that he can bone out for any reason. Like, maybe he's like, oh, you want to march, you know, or whatever the Danny and John, he was going to have some objections. Like, this is not the thing I signed up for. Bullshit, I'm out.
Right.
And they've already worked out going and getting the Golden Company.
And it just so happened that there was a very, very good reason for him
to, so it's like,
off.
Yeah, like the fact that, and the fact, and, you know, if he bones off and, you know, later Cersei sends him a raven saying, no, it's cool. Like, I mean, to me, it works either way. Either they knew exactly what was going to happen and planned it all, or, like you said, they were improvising the whole thing with the general idea that at some point, because that's before they saw the corpse, Euron was already causing these divisions.
Right.
Which makes a hell of a lot of sense when you think of it in terms of them just, you know, doing this whole play acting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other question is, like, how deep does that go? Like, why, I guess my big question is, why did she change her mind and say, like, not agree to armistice and then storm off if her plan was to convince them that she was going to march north with them after all.
I feel like this is her plan to actually convince them. Like, if she says, okay, fine. I think what happens here is she knows that she can ask for something that she'll never get, right? Yeah. She understands who Ned is very, very deeply, right?
And she knows that that's something she, yeah.
And she knows, therefore, who John is. And right. So when she asks for this thing that he can't give...
But she doesn't know he can't give it. That's the thing. And the other thing is... Here's the other thing before we get to the scene is it seems to me that the position that she's in at the end where she says, yes, we will march north and stand together is a much less strong position than saying, all right, I'll withdraw my forces and stay here because – and it'd be one thing if she sent like a token force just so she could – because she brings up this point of like, oh, yes, you're going to go march north on this magical crusade and I'm just going to pull my forces back and not have any scouts and no sources of information, about what you're doing. It just seems like now if she did that, then the allies go north and they don't know that Cersei's betraying them or they don't know they're getting the Golden Company. They're going to know very quickly because Jaime's writing out the meeting. He's like, oh, yeah, my sister just fucked us all.
No, I think Jaime defected this episode.
I do, but he's going really to go tell Jon like, hey, yes, all that thing that Cersei. Yeah. So like so now what is the point of the subterfuge? Because the subterfuge is I guess that's where Cersei just miscalculated on Jaime. She thought she
either that or she's still betting on Jaime not totally defecting.
But also, at some point, like John and Dany, as they're mounting their forces at Winterfell and moving on to Muzzle, are like, hey, aren't we expecting like 10,000 Lannisters to jetpack
in? Checking their watch.
Yeah. Like, you know, when we jetpacked in, we had a northerly wind helping us out, made us, but still, the jetpacks work, right? Like, it seems like that this is just a weaker position. So that's the one thing that bothers me. But also, yeah. I'm not going to make the mistake of calling bullshit on his plan until I see it work out because
The other thing is she might just be forcing them to waste time expecting her to do something,
right?
You know, like if it's a last minute thing where they look at their watches and Cersei's troops aren't there but they've got to go anyway,
right? It's like
they have no choice.
It's like Jon and Battle of the Bastards, like,
and she puts Dany
in
a weaker position.
She wants to bleed them out, and if they're relying on them for extra forces, that they're going to plan on something that's not going to come true, that
and then they'll have a hastily improvised plan.
I mean,
you know
that's bad military strategy,
right?
So, and which means it's going to kill a lot of Targaryens and Northerners, and that's good for Cersei.
Yeah.
Now,
I think the strategy is pretty sound.
The problem with it is, like, she's still got to know that if the Northerners die, it's not like they're bleeding each other out. Every person that the Night King's killed makes him stronger. I think that's the one thing she's still... But the thing is I buy it because in the books, Cersei is unfathomably arrogant and almost as unfathomably dense.
Yeah.
So I could see her, and like this is actually one of her more elegant plots if it comes to fruition in the books. But so many like her turning over the kingdom to the fucking Faith Militant. Mm-hmm. Oh, with one stroke I've saw the even my father could never see me doing. And then she's you know, like when she's talking about Tyrion, like the jackals ripping and the vultures ripping at her. I'm like, no, you did you let him.
Yeah.
You like laid down, coated yourself with barbecue sauce and said, come on, rip us apart, Faith Militant and Tyra and everybody else. I mean,
yeah.
So like it works either way. Like she's either taking a level in Master Strategist or this is just another dumb Cersei plot that Jaime sees for what it is. And he's like, no, fuck this.
I mean, I'm almost morally certain that she will regret this, you know.
I mean
I don't think Cersei's sitting on the Iron Throne at the end of this thing, so
yeah, it just depends.
This even if it's a brilliant strategy, I think she's still done for,
and
it's
that's
just a last ditch.
And by the way, this here is also why I don't like I'm not on the like Littlefinger should have gone out better way. No, Littlefinger ran out to the end of his rope.
Hell yeah,
this is what happens when you run out to what was his other master play to run away and sit out the, like...
He's played all his cards. He has no cards in hand, and he's facing a deck
but,
full of gas.
But I'm saying, like, yeah, this, like, I felt like that, you know, again, the reason that I'm free with my criticism and I don't agree with it, so people hopefully believe me when I'm on the other end, like, I really do think that most of this stuff tracks with... It didn't make strict logical sense, but all this stuff at the end does seem like it derives from what these characters would actually do as I know them.
Mm-hmm.
There's none like, you know, so let's continue. We can develop
except
that
for
point.
The mountain, who seems almost completely useless as a bodyguard. Like this white comes
hurt?
Charging in.
Who got hurt?
Nobody.
He's a pretty damn good bodyguard.
He didn't fucking move when this white comes charging in. to snap at Cersei.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people thinking that the Mountain would have been better off if he, or it had been better off if the Mountain had like cut the thing in half and it still didn't die, so they could show how futile, like even your strongest defender is going to be nothing. Now, could be the Mountain stayed his hand out of professional courtesy to a fellow zombie.
You think so?
Yeah. Brother. I wonder what's going, because the other thing about Sandor is like he saw right away that like, yeah, you're my brother, but you're not really my brother.
I still wants to kill him though.
I wonder like what is going on at the Mountain. I don't think we're ever going to get the answers to that, but like what exactly biologically, scientifically is making him tick? Like, does he have any agency at all left?
I don't know.
Is he only loyalty to Cersei? Is Qyburn got a backdoor into him so when things look lost he can, you know,
climb in and pilot him like a mech?
Or just be like, you know, Order 66 and he kills Cersei.
Oh yeah.
And he's like, okay, now put me on your shoulders and run as fast as you can south. I will swim to the Summer Isles on your back, Sir Gregor.
So John's calling this the Great War. Did he make that up or is that something from the books?
I don't know. I think he's biting on World War One.
Okay.
He's listening to too many Dan Carlin podcasts.
Yeah. And then we
seems like a terrible war to me. Nothing great about it.
We didn't really talk about it. I didn't even mention it, but there's the moment between Jaime and Brienne where she's trying to convince him. She basically tells the Oathbreaker, fuck loyalty.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right move.
But I also thought it was great how when, you know, Jaime's coming in with Cersei, like he was cold as ice to her. Didn't even acknowledge her.
Yeah.
So she was like, and also I think she's got a point. And the character that's the biggest proponent of loyalty and oath saying, seriously, this is horse shit. Do you not see the crazy zombie?
Yeah.
Like this is not someone you can parlay with. This is not someone you can get an armistice out of. This is not someone who will grant you lands or castles or any concession. Like, this is all so much bullshit. Like, I think she's really bought into John's overall thesis of it's the dead versus the living.
For sure.
And anyone that's not on the living side is bad news.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked earlier where the Dragon Pit is because the Lannisters just kind of leave them totally unattended at this Dragon Pit at
right,
the end.
Right.
Like, really, you're going to leave your fiercest enemies within your walls totally unattended? That's surprising. That's,
right. But, well, but when you want to leave in a huff.
Yeah.
You got to leave in a huff.
You either do or you don't.
Also, what do you think of John's speech about, you know, essentially, if enough people make false promises, the words mean nothing.
He's right. He's absolutely right.
But that's we talked about this last week. Like, that's the ultimate political quicksand that, like, you know, might makes right, and I'll do the good thing once I get into power. But by the time you get into power, you've compromised so many things that define the right thing that you kind of lose your way. I do think it gets every time you fucking break a promise or do something wrong, it becomes easier to do so the next time.
Sure.
So the problem in real life is that lying is just such a excellent tool for getting one out of problems. And by the time it no longer works, you're so fucked anyway, it doesn't matter. So, like, there's almost no downside to the first few lies you tell.
Yeah, and also, like, it sort of creates an unlevel playing field, too.
Yeah.
When one of your enemies is able to lie and you're not, that's the problem here. Like, if they were straight up facing Cersei here and it was Jon versus Cersei, I think Cersei would probably win just because Jon's too much like his father.
Yeah, and I think that's where Jon misses it. Like, the fact that, like, this is the game and this is the way it's played. The thing is, if both sides lie, that's fine as long as you know what the other person would do rationally. And that's why North Korea is such a huge problem, because what will these people do rationally? Can you we can think about what the Soviet Union would do when it comes to nukes rationally. Does this person who's a third generation god king going to act rationally when it comes to his people's best interests and all that politically? I don't know. And that's the thing with Cersei. It's like, yeah, it's not the problem that she lies, because like Lady Olenna and Tywin long time played the game knowing each other lying, but they're like, well, the Lannisters actually need this and I actually need this. So even between the lies, you can see where their interests line up. But Cersei, who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
But John,
I feel like the Game of Thrones,
right?
You either lie or you lose. Like,
right. It's a prisoner's dilemma, right? Yeah. Like it's statistic. It's beneficial if everyone collaborates, but yet the disparity between one collaborating and one betraying is so good that like the logical thing to do is both betray.
Right.
It's fucking crazy, man. Game theory is insane.
Okay, ready to move on?
Yes.
Before going to speak with Cersei, Tyrion and Jaime say their goodbyes, one idiot to another. Tyrion speaks with Cersei. Cersei basically tuts him for destroying their family by killing Tywin, and he suggests that she have the mountain kill him and tries to goad her into it, but she can't do it. So he pours them both a drink and insists that he love the children. Cersei doesn't care about him or anything. She only cares about her family and herself, essentially, here. And Tyrion realizes through her mannerisms that she's pregnant. Congratulations, Tyrion. You've fallen into her trap.
I think that the dialogue here was great. Like, when Cersei comes, of course she goes, oh, you know, you've brought another foreign whore who doesn't know her place into the Red Keep. And he's like, oh, and this one you can't bully or intimidate or kidnap.
Yep.
And then the fact that she tries to pull this children thing on him and he's like, you know, like, you know that I love your children. I always did. I mean, it's debatable about Joffrey, but Tommen and Marcella were decent kids. And she knows that. And here he challenges, like, did you think that Tyrion could actually die here?
Yeah, I did.
I did a little bit, not as strongly as Jaime, but, like, I did, and, like, I thought that Peter Dinklage really sold the relief, like, when he called the bluff and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. This is where all the conspiracy theories is born. They're drinking wine and talking about how much they love the family, and then the next time she comes forth, she's got this duplicitous plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of people are saying, well, Tyrion is... And maybe he doesn't see it as betraying Dany, but he's doing something like promising her the Westerlands or, like, you know, Casterly Rock back, that she can be the Lord's Protector or some kind of, like, power sharing that Dany's not into. I just don't see any evidence for it other than the fact that the absence of evidence.
Right. The absence of evidence certainly could just mean he had a conversation where he, quote unquote, convinced her.
Right.
All part of her plan, but
right.
He thinks it's not. The other thing is, maybe there's a little bit of evidence for... I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate because I don't know that I believe this.
Uh-huh.
But there is a little bit of evidence where Cersei says, I trust that you will remember this, like that I came to help you. But it's all part of a ruse,
and it's
right?
It's all this, like, passive-aggressive narcissist bullshit. Like, I'm going to do the right thing, but you guys won't appreciate it, and you won't remember it, and like all this, like, okay, whatever.
I mean, Tyrion would have to be in on the ruse at this point.
I do think, here's the one criticism of the scene, is I don't know why Dany didn't have anything to offer Cersei. Because Cersei had a dead point. It's like, why should I agree to this when it's essentially calling time out so you can gather your strength and kick me in the ass later?
Yeah.
Like, I thought it would have been a lot more clever if Tyrion had come in with an offer like, we will restore your rights to Casterly Rock in return for this and guarantee you sovereignty over blah, 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 or whatever, you know? Like, essentially giving them back the status quo before the Targaryen Rebellion ever happened.
Yeah.
And that, to Cersei, is a big loss, but it's something. They didn't give her anything. They didn't even give her Jon Snow saying, I will be neutral in the fight. Like, they gave her nothing.
I think what they give her, and what's implied here with cutting from Tyrion realizing she's pregnant to her saying, I'm on your side, is they gave her child the opportunity to live.
Oh,
like,
Tyrion, you're right.
Once that scene cuts, Tyrion is able to convince her, because of her child, that the best course of strategy, the only course of strategy here for her child's life, is to cooperate.
And I think that if they had shown that, where Tyrion realized she's pregnant and now knows that something, but like, Tyrion came into that meeting not knowing that she's pregnant and knowing that Cersei's power mad, doesn't care about her life or anyone in the realms and protecting anyone. Like that's the whole thing. The whole, like, part of the whole spiel about, you know, Queen of the First Men and the Andals and all that is, like, you're also defender of the realm.
Sure.
And she completely shirks that ability, and Tyrion fucking knows that. So he came in with nothing to offer her.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that they had at least tried, because, like, I don't think Cersei would take it, but that's at least, you know, that's a pretty big carrot to, like, look, bygones, last 20 years, bygones, we'll go back to the state of the way things were.
Yeah.
And the fact that they didn't, I felt, was a little short-sighted and made, you know, made Dany look pig-headed, which they kind of have. I feel like maybe that's starting to be just a character trait. She's a little bit pig-headed. Like, I'm not going to give her shit. I'm not going to give Johnson. I'm going to recognize Johnson. He's got to bend the fucking knee.
Right. I do think, you know, despite what maybe they could have done more, I think this is the scene that really, to me, says, hey, this is a return to form for Game of Thrones. Like, two characters who have a storied history sitting down together and having a conversation over, you know, one of them over wine.
Well, this goes back to, like, I read the interesting thread on Reddit last week where it's like, you know, people are talking about this boneheaded white plan, and they're like, it would have been better had Cersei come up with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if they had had this parlay and she's like, well, I don't believe you and this is bullshit. Like, it's obvious. Like, if you know, like, and I think most reasonable viewers would look at that and be like, okay, well, yeah, you can't come to this queen and say, lay down your arms so we can take care of this threat that no one's ever heard of. And it sounds like bullshit with no guarantees or anything. And then they strike on the idea that, like, oh, we need to bring someone back to convince Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, that happens all the time. Like, the hero gets an impossible quest from, you know, the villain, and he has to go. Like, I feel like that, and it's weird. I didn't think of that until I saw the thread, but, like, it is weird that they didn't think of, like, little details like that. Like, just change the pacing around a little bit. Instead of the heroes coming up with a crazy plan, make it some kind of impossible challenge the villain throws down at them.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't matter in the end anyway, because, of course, it doesn't. But that's what I'm saying. Like, this was good. But I do think even in the finale, there could have been a few touches that would have made it even better.
So we kind of talked mostly about this scene. I'm just going to recap it real quick and then move on. Dany tells Jon that she respects what he did, and they talk about the dragon pits being the end of her family. And she kind of laments the loss of the dragons and as such her family. Jon says she's still alive, so her family is still alive, and that she might still be able to have kids despite the crazy old witch's prophecy.
I like Dany's face there. Like, she's like, oh, John, so sweet, you mansplaining the fact that I haven't had a period. And it's not just a witch, you idiot.
Right.
Like, I haven't had my moon's blood for 3 years now or whatever. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, let's have the man sit down and teach the woman how the reproductive system works.
Yeah. I feel like that it would have been way more convincing if it was like Melisandre, right? Like, listen. Prophecies?
Yeah, sure.
Not all they're cracked up to be.
Right. But then it's like, that's the thing. Like, I know they haven't established that on the show, but, like, that'd be a real thing if, like, she's suddenly turned barren. And I also, it's probably possible to get a period and still be infertile. I don't understand it either.
He asks what's next. And
when there's instance of a legitimate heir, Dany's body will have a way of, like, starting that whole thing up.
I guess so.
That's
life finds a way.
Yes, exactly.
So he asks what's next. He realizes they're fucked. And then Tyrion shows up, followed by Cersei, who says she'll send her armies to the cause up north and fight alongside them. We know that's bullshit. Then we go over to Winterfell, where Sansa worries about Jon's message. And Littlefinger says, you know, you could just unname Jon as king in the north, and you could take the title, become Lady of Winterfell. She says Arya wouldn't allow it. Littlefinger says, tells her how to understand Arya's motivations, essentially, by playing his version of the game of faces, which is assume the worst. She plays the game and realizes that Arya could be here to kill her and become the Lady of Winterfell. We know this is all a ruse, eventually.
And I think that, like, there's a lot of ways you can read what's going on here, but I think that it's pretty clear that, if nothing else, this is the point where Sansa realized she's being played. Because the end, the thing that Littlefinger's guiding her towards, Sansa knows in her bones that that's not Arya's motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, last episode was about Arya convincing herself that Sansa was true blue for Starks, playing the game of faces with her, and then letting Sansa make the decision because she can't force her.
Right.
And this was the episode where, like, she's like, wait, Arya's doing this to be the Lady of fucking Winterfell? Arya's never wanted to be the Lady of Winterfell. This is bullshit. I'm a slow learner, but I have finally learned, and now I'm going to fuck you.
I feel like in this scene, question number two, like, what is her motivation? And she's already onto Littlefinger, and she's using the questions that he's asking to measure him.
Right.
You know? She's saying Arya, but she's meaning Littlefinger.
Right. And there's also hints that, of course, a meeting between the Starks happened because, you know, Arya gave Sansa the knife.
Mm-hmm.
When she executes Peter, she's got the knife. So we know, like, there's multiple hints of this isn't just something we're just guessing at. There's multiple hints that, you know, Arya figured out something about Sansa last episode. Sansa figured out something about Arya last episode. now here's evidence that they've worked together. Here's the wild card brand. And now
I like what you said in the instant take, but, because storytelling, like, it's a right. way more interesting way to tell this story.
And people
than
are
to
like,
lay it all out.
Well, what is this scene for? Is it for Arya, or is it for Sansa, or is it for the Lords of the North?
It's, and for
it's
us.
Like, it's for the audience.
Yeah.
It's fun. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ.
Right.
Why did Peter jump up behind Ned and put a knife to his neck?
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally every gold cloak in the room and the fucking Kingsguard and, like, the Hound had swords out. Like, that's dumb. Why would Peter take the risk that Ned would break him in half?
To
because
reveal
it was fucking
the betrayal
cool.
to the audience.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so he could get that stinger of a line.
Yep. All right. John plans their journey to Winterfell. When I say there, I mean everybody. Jorah suggests that Dany fly instead of traveling with Jon so that she can't get killed by the angry Northerners.
And also so you won't be able to be boned by Jon, because I'm trying to cockblock Jon as hard as I
Give
ever can.
Give it up, Jorah. I Give mean, it up,
it's,
man.
It was so transparent. I mean,
yeah.
It was definitely good advice, but it was coming from yeah. a place of, like, you know, dishonest intent, I think.
For sure.
He doesn't like this handsome northerner that's...
And John's doing the same, right? When he says, oh, the northerners need to see us as allies. No, fuck you.
Yeah,
fuck
no,
you,
no,
man.
It's all aboard the love boat, Danny. Come on.
Right.
Come on.
So, yeah, John says they need to travel together. Danny agrees.
Mm-hmm.
Where exactly is White Harbor? I'm curious.
It is on the west coast of Westeros, right,
okay.
just immediately, like, north of the Neck, and it's where the Manderleys own that, and it's the richest port. It's the richest port. It's the richest town in the north by far, most populous, too.
So are they sailing there to meet up and then hike to Winterfell? Or?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so, because there's probably more roads, and it'd probably be the swiftest way to sail around Westeros and go there and then travel overland.
Okay.
Honestly, the logistics of this doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Why doesn't Dany just fly her? Like, here's the thing. Both of you take the dragon.
Here's my big question.
Like, you've done
how?
It before. Just fly together in Winterfell and be like, kaboom, we are the fucking super couple.
Yeah, but... My biggest question in this whole scene is how? How are they sailing anywhere?
Why?
They have no fleet. It all got burned or destroyed.
No, they've got... They
no,
got, they...
no, everything. Euron destroyed Yara's fleet that was going south.
But Tyrion
the
said...
The fleet at Casterly Rock got destroyed when
Tyrion
when they
said
took
two
it.
Episodes ago that... And I even pointed out how absurd it was, but he said, we have just enough fleet to do something. I forget what it
so
was.
So they have fleet
but...
in reserve?
Plus,
for 100
John's got
raggies?
Boats. The North has got boats. John had all those boats that Stannis left them.
Hmm.
I mean, dude, I'm not going
it's
to...
Suspect.
But
no,
I'll
believe
shit.
It.
No shit. Shit.
I'll
like, I want to see the kayak receipts for all this. I want to see the Travelocity bookings, but we're not going to get them, so jetpacks for everybody.
Yep. Okay, Theon tells Jon that he's ashamed of his actions, and he can't decide whether he's a Greyjoy or a Stark. Jon says, you're both, which seems to make sense to Theon. So he goes out to the Iron Islanders and tells them, we're going to save Yara. Tough guy says no. He beats Theon senseless. Theon refuses to stay down and gets the upper hand when the guy goes for a low blow. Theon wins the fight, and they set off in a tiny boat to go save Yara. At least I think that's what happens at the end of this scene.
Yeah.
It's a very small boat.
I mean, so...
Yara did kind of the same thing in a tiny boat, but...
Yeah. They're like the SEAL Team 6 of Greyjoy. The Squid Team 6.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I really like the scene between Theon and Jon.
I do too.
And I think this is another way that Jon is an excellent leader, because he's got this ally. He doesn't like him. He's got every reason to hate him, but he sees there's genuine remorse here. Mm-hmm. And instead of kicking the guy while he's down and making him less valuable, he gives the guy a hand up and says, like, this is what tormented Theon before. He didn't want to make that choice between being a Greyjoy and a Stark, and mm-hmm. he was forced to do so.
Yep.
And he's been punished for it ever since. So, I like the idea that he gives the mission. I just feel like this whole invincible, everything about the like the fact that he won those men to his side just because he wore this guy out from kneeing his crotch 2 months and then beat him half to death, and then it's for Yara. Like, Theon used to be pretty good with a sword, and like I thought that like this is going to be story was is like all he needed was confidence and from some kindness and forgiveness, and he didn't even get from his sister,
mm-hmm.
and that was going to remind him of who the fuck he was, and he's going to go there and take care of business. But we go with the invincible crotch. By the way, it was a joke, but thank you for all the ladies who informed me that, yes, indeed, getting kicked in the clit is not a good experience.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah, no. So, like, myth confirmed.
I was going to say, busted. I can't imagine, but I can totally imagine. It would not feel good.
Yeah, like, any place, like being kicked in your hip bone would hurt. There's no place where there's, like, thin layer of skin over bone.
Elbow, maybe.
I mean, that's the funny bone. You don't want to mess with your funny bone.
Yeah.
It's even worse.
Yeah, I don't know. The pointy part.
Let me tell you what. Right now, I'll make this offer. I will settle it. I'll kick you as hard as I can in your elbow. Do you take that deal?
No, I'm not interested.
Because you know it's going to fucking hurt.
Not interested. So here's the thing. I think this scene was all about proving Bronn and Jamie's conversation from the beginning untrue, where the Cockless do fight for their families.
Yeah.
Because Theon has a family.
I mean, there is a low key. All the undesirables in the world are banding together to rule,
to fight for what's
the
right.
The eunuchs, the dwarves, the women, the slaves. They're all coming together and saying, "Fuck this bullshit order. We're going to make a change."
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that the people in power, like Jaime, don't see is that
right.
They've had an easy life, right? In as much as anybody in that world has an easy life, they've been the privileged.
Sure.
And they can't imagine a scenario in which people would be downtrodden.
Right.
And so when you get a whole bunch of people who aren't fighting for their own selfish desires,
right.
They're just fighting to generally make the world better. They can't understand it.
Or they think that the downtrodden are there because they're too stupid to be a lord or lady.
Yeah, sure. You know? Right. They're too stupid to be born into royalty.
Right. Yeah.
Nobility.
Yeah, like, you know, claw your way up like Bronn of the Blackwater.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of that. Now, it's interesting because it's you know, history's replete with the downtrodden throwing over the privileged and then making a fucking mess of things.
Sure.
Lots of revolutions start off with good, and that's the thing where I don't... You know, George has always talked about, like, he's got many criticisms of Tolkien while still acknowledging his greatness. But one of the things is, like, I want to know what happens after the war. Like, do the orcs all die? Do they come up with peace with the human? Like, I wonder how much we'll get that in the series because it's easy to imagine Dany having a lot of problems breaking the wheel and getting the society to work. Like, that's a big ask, and that's a big job, and you could tell a lot of cool stories about the fits and starts of that. But I don't know, because it seems like there's barely enough time to finish the main plot and then to have, like, the scouring of the Shire afterlogue where, you know, the hobbits go back to the Shire and set things right. I don't know.
I thought that was weird
even when I read it in Return of the King. Like, really? We're going to go back and the hobbits are going to fucking... kick ass in the Shire, okay.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you look at historically in our real world, when cities or nations have been conquered, the integration is a huge problem. And it comes down to a lot of things, religion being a primary one, right? Dany doesn't share the religion of the vast majority of the people in this land. So how is she going to bring them to her side?
I mean, America's known as the melting pot, and we fuck it up all the time.
Right.
Like, every time you introduce a new element in the melting pot, oh, this is going to be the one that fucks it all up, guys.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't think they'll really have time to get to the end.
Yeah.
Well, once they get to the end of the series. Anyway, we go back to Winterfell. Sansa has Arya called to the Great Hall. She pulls a switcheroo on Littlefinger and convicts him of murder instead of Arya and treason also.
I still love the performance there.
He just, it's great. What name did they say?
And I went back and forth about whether Aiden Gillian was too much. Like, there's this one point where he's on his knees begging for it and his voice is cracking. But I'm like, I mean, that might be a put on. He's trying to appeal to Sansa's softer side. So. Yeah. Like, he's got no pride. Blubber.
Sure.
Like, Ned wouldn't blubber, but, you know, Littlefinger would.
Yeah, he's just trying to get out of the situation. He tries to defend himself with words, but Arya cuts his throat. And that's pretty much the scene. I think, there was an absolutely perfect reaction from Aiden Gillen in this scene. And then I think his performance was great all around. I'm sure some people have problems with it, but
so now we did say that this scene was for the audience as a crowd pleaser, but I also do think it should any scenes like that should also be underpinned by some kind of logic. And I do think there's something to be said because Littlefinger has been going to all these lords and making overtures, and you know, Sansa's not sure what all they know, and there is a excuse to kind of like, you know, some of this theatrics for the Northern Lord. So like, you know, we can drop this guy betrayed Ned Stark, who everybody in this room loves. This guy portrayed, you know, Lysa Arryn and John, like, who everyone probably had mixed emotions about, but John Arryn, which everybody loved. And, like, just getting that all out to where, like, you know, all these facts are on the table and everyone's got this surge of kind of like, yeah, fuck Littlefinger, not give him a chance to, you know, not arrest him and send him into jail for however many long to let him come up with a scheme.
Yeah, and just sprinkle gold on people and weasel his way out of it.
And there's also another thread is people saying, why didn't Littlefinger get the fuck out as soon as Bran started saying, oh, I saw you climbing this chaos ladder? Like, but I'm like, I think number one, Littlefinger's allowed to have a tragic flaw, and that is his soft spot for Sansa. And it's not like that he won't sell her out to the Rand, but like, I do think that he is trying to navigate this picture of him on the Iron Throne with Sansa by his side. Going away from Winterfell and running does not, that just rips up the picture and admits defeat.
Yeah. Also, like, okay, Bran says some surprising things.
Right.
But what conclusion do you jump to from that? That he can see everything that's ever happened?
Right.
And that he could peek in on memories that he knows no one was there to see?
Yeah, like I don't even think Bran knows. Like, I think this episode establishes that we talked about it in the beginning, and I floated his theory as like, well, maybe, you know, his mind is like a Dewey Decimal System and a library, and he can know anything, but he has to know where to look, and he has to know the right things, and that seems right. So I think it's a stretch to be like Littlefinger's going to completely abandon his life's work. Mm-hmm. Because in his mind, I've played sister against sister. I've put family against family. I will be able to sort this out. And what he didn't count on is Ned's lesson to his family was stronger than all that about how the fact that and that's why it didn't work, because this pack stayed together and didn't freeze anybody out. So I thought it worked. I thought it was all there. Like it took four episodes and also I thought it was right for Arya and Sansa to have a little bit of enmity and suspicion of each other because there was a lot of good reasons and they needed to sort that out. And I thought this was a pretty interesting and thrilling way to do it.
I agree. So I'm gonna jump in here for a second and say people who are casual viewers might be wondering why Littlefinger doesn't try and weasel out by asking for a trial by combat or something. And it's because the North doesn't honor those traditions. That's a Faith of the Seven sort of thing.
Right.
So they don't have a trial by combat up North. So he couldn't have even if he wanted to.
It's a debate. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't try. And then Sansa could be like, we don't follow the...
He probably knows that.
I'm just saying it would have... I do think that they showed him trying to peel the Jon Royce. And then that was hilarious. Like, I think not.
Right.
And then, like, I just felt like they the pacing could have been improved by having him flail to something else. Like, I demand trial by combat. And then Sansa's like, okay, anyone want to champion Littlefinger? And
it's not even a custom we do up like, here,
She's like, I mean, that would have been a badass scene. It's like, does anyone want to be my champion? And, like, literally every man unsheathes a sword. And then anyone for Littlefinger? And her side's like, okay. Give Lord Baelish a weapon to defend. Yeah, I'm doing fucking fan fiction now. The shit I hate, but I think there again, it could have been better, but it was pretty damn good and all consistent with the characters.
That was great.
And now I think Sansa and Arya both have turned permanent. Turned a permanent course in their characters now. They're like they're set in stone. And it took a while to get there, but I like where we're at.
Okay, so Jaime's planning the march north with their forces. Cersei excuses everyone and tells Jaime, we're not doing any of that because I lied about the expedition north. She also reveals that the ruse with Euron was exactly that, and he's actually going to pick up the Golden Company to take back the lands they've lost. Jaime's pissed that she didn't tell him and says he intends to honor his pledge to ride north. She calls it treason and threatens to have the Mountain kill him. It's fortunately, I think, a bluff, and Jaime calls it, and then he rides out of the city where it starts snowing. I'm probably going to recap this, but we get an awesome montage of kind of just a lot of different views of King's Landing as it begins to snow and the snow starts to stick and mount. It's real ominous.
Yeah.
And that slowed down kind of low-key version of the Game of Thrones theme really works here.
And they're showing the darkness settling over King's Landing. Yeah. Like, again, I think we're going to go to dark places with Cersei next year. Because I mentioned that on the take about her, like, just sitting there brooding like some giant spider in her web with her child in her belly, and just and Qyburn whispering in her ear, and a mountain glowering around, and King's Landing under all this gloom, and people starving. It's going to be fucking dire shit.
Yeah.
Also, 20,000 men, horses, and elephants. That sounds like a pretty fucking cool battle.
Yeah, war elephants.
Yeah, like I'm guessing that,
where's their Legolas? They can't have elephants without a Legolas sliding down their trunks.
Right. They had a Legolas back in the Brother Without Banners back in like season 4, and he must have gotten caught up in the mass hangings that Beric hung everyone but himself and Thoros. Like,
yeah,
the band of brothers met a bad end. Yeah, but this tease of the Golden Company I thought was pretty cool. So, to be honest, there's another piece of evidence where the people are latching onto the Tyrion as spy theory, whereas when Cersei says, "I always knew you were the stupidest Lannister," she's comparing that to her brother Tyrion and saying, like, even Tyrion was smart enough to see the obvious play here, and you're too stupid.
Maybe.
That's, you know,
I mean, circumstantial evidence. Evidence by omission.
But it is a bit of evidence there. And I thought also that... So, do you believe that Cersei's smart enough to draw the connection between the missing dragon, or is that more evidence that perhaps she's got an inside man or woman?
I mean, the way she lays it out, it seems logically pretty obvious, you know? Because I agree, the first thing I thought when Dany rolls up with the Unsullied and the Dothraki and her dragons is she's displaying her power.
Right.
And you don't display 2/3 of your power.
But it's also, you know, Jamie had a good point that it could be protecting what's left of her fleet because she's got all of her power here.
Yeah, I like Cersei's reaction. Just, meh.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think that, like, that's a reasonable inference a person could make.
Yeah, I do too.
Especially, I mean, that is, I think, a problem with geopolitics is that everyone kind of plays the worst case scenario. And, you know, it keeps you safe, but it also really makes you paranoid. But she's right in this case. So
yeah, she is, and you can really see. I don't know. This scene is so wrapped up in Jaime's character, who he is. Like, he cannot tolerate this. He still holds some value for his honor.
Sure,
you know,
and that's something that's
made an oath.
That's been something that's been developed since the steam baths of what, season 2, 3.
Kind of, I mean, even before, like, the whole thing with the Mad King. I mean, it goes all the way back with Jaime.
Sure.
And the things he's done and the
times
he's regretted it.
But I'm saying that's when he first kind of, we got his side. We always heard Ned's side. Oh, I came and you're lounging on the throne of the king you just slayed, you bastard. And
right.
Like, the fact that it really hurts Jaime to be a man that he doesn't want to be. Jaime wanted to be a Brienne.
Right.
That was his heart's desire, and he's been forced to be a Lannister.
And I think after this scene, what do you even call it? Bramey?
Bramey? Oh, Bramey,
GN?
Yeah.
the Bramey shippers can rejoice, I think, now that Jaime could be turning to the other side here.
It
won't be across a battlefield. It'll be on the same side of the battlefield.
Although I feel like they've really harshed the chemistry between him and Brienne by introducing the Tormund Brienne. Although she's not...
Well, it's another classic love triangle, right?
Sure.
The Jon, Jorah, Dany thing.
Yeah. But I liked it. So some people wondered if him putting on the black glove over his golden hand is like symbolizing him, like metaphorically taking the black, because that especially is relevant with Beric and Jon kind of like saying that that's what they're doing. They are all the Night's Watch now.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a potentially neat bit of symbolism. I also really loved his desperation talking to Cersei, like, do not see how crazy this is. And Cersei doesn't really have an answer. Like, the only way this works is if the living defeat the dead but are crippled in a way that she can then mop up the scraps. That's a pretty low percentage play. But from her perspective, since she will not accept any kind of thing that doesn't end up with her being on the Iron Throne with her family ruling this dynasty, that's the problem. They just can't see how important that is to her.
Yeah, it's pretty much the only play for her.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, try and get them to fight amongst each other and then sweep up the... whatever remains.
Yeah.
Okay, we move on to Sam going to Winterfell, where he meets Bran, who thanks him for helping on his journey. Sam tells him he's here to help Jon, and Bran says he's on his way back to Winterfell with Dany. He also says that he needs to know that Jon's the son of Rhaegar Targaryen, and his mother Liana.
Yep.
Start, and that his real name is Sand, not Snow. And Sam's also, like, no, actually, this marriage is official. John's not a bastard.
Also, I did a lot of research on this. Bran doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about anyway. Like, you get your bastard name from your mother, not where you're born.
Oh, well, then.
But
Bran needed to study
harder,
Maester
Lewin. But
that's the
thing. That was a part of his character.
Right.
He shirked his studies.
Yeah.
He didn't want to learn the house words and the name. And like, you know, who's a bastard where? Who gives a shit? I'm never going to be a bastard. That's John's problem. So like, I don't even mind it.
He doesn't need the studying now because he can just go back and look, which he does. Right. He looks at the marriage. He looks at the Tower of Joy. And he confirms that actually John's real name is Aegon Targaryen.
Yeah.
Mind blown.
Yeah. Oh man, there's a lot. So this is another
probably
going
to talk mostly in the spoilers about this, right? But
well, I mean, the problem here is Rhaegar already had a son named Aegon, and Oberyn told us that was his name, and that son got his brains bashed in by Gregor the Mountain. So this kind of makes Rhaegar out to be the George Foreman of Westeros, where he's just like, oh, I got a male son,
yeah,
Aegon, Aegon
George.
The second,
they're
Aegon, the, oh, wait, we're already on to the sixth, the seventh, the eighth, what, like, and also a lot of people made this point, and I agree with them, if you're going to reveal a Targaryen name, Aemon would have been the way to go, because that way, you've got John carrying his, you know, Ned's blood of the Starks. He's got the blade of Jor Mormont, and the name of his other mentor at the Wall, Aemon Targaryen. Mm-hmm. And he's carrying that all in the battle with them, which would mean those are all things that are important and valuable to him.
Made him who he is. Yeah.
And going with Aegon is just like, I don't know why. There's so many fucking Aegons.
You'll understand it when Rhaegar announces his fat busting grill next season.
Right. Now it's based on Dragonfire. So lean. So it just really leans out the meat.
Yeah.
There are, yeah, obviously some implications we can talk about in the spoiler section on Friday, but I don't know. And this also cemented like how Bran's power works. A lot of people had an issue with like, well, why did he seem a lot more human with Sam, and he was such a shit to Mira? But I think that's actually an intentional thing. They're showing you Bran got all this knowledge thrust upon him when he wasn't ready, and now a season later he's a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
He's learned to be a little bit more human. That's interesting, because I always thought Mira was going to exist to humanize Bran. It seems like she's gone. Like, I don't know if she's got another part to play, because it seems like he's learning to be a little bit more human just all on his own.
I don't know. It's debatable how human he is, because presumably he sees the banging happening.
Yeah.
And he does not do anything to prevent it, even though Jon is banging
his
aunt.
He didn't know where to look. Maybe he saw Kit Harington's ass and started questioning things deep about himself. Because I got to say, I've never seen anything like that. Like, on subsequent watchings, like,
notice.
Kit, oh, well, brother, let me tell you.
I guess I got to go back and check it out. Huh?
That thing is round and tight and in your face and milky white.
Danny's
unblemished
against the sheets, so I couldn't see
obviously that's the thing that caught my eye the first time, but like, I'm telling you what, the dude does not skip squat day. It's ridiculous.
I don't know. Bran should have just made it super fucking windy in that room or something and just shut the
just
whole thing
just
down.
Just a gale force is blowing through. It's like, is someone trying to tell me something?
Just start shouting.
Yeah.
No!
There's this, this is one of the funniest things I've ever seen the internet produce, but it was like on some kind of Photoshop Friday back in the old Something Awful forums, where someone's photoshopped old Ben Kenobi's ghost, where Leia was kissing Luke on Hoth, and he was doing the like, oh no, face. And like, I feel like that's a little bit Bran here.
Yeah.
And it's also a little bit of us at the audience, because like, I wasn't going to talk about this. But
it's also like, Tyrion. We'll talk about that too.
A lot of people have been saying this, like they talked about this a lot on Watch the Throne. The Ringer show. Are they trying to normalize incest on this show?
Normalize it in a fictional world where it's already kind of normalized within that family.
I know, it's just weird.
Like, it's not going to make me go out and bang my cousin.
I know, but I'm telling you, dude. Like, if you go to like any of the porn hubs, like the incest category is like super popular. And like,
well,
and I
maybe,
like,
look, maybe they don't need to normalize
it. I'm not
going to
like the morals and ethics of it. Okay, uh-huh. I'm just saying there's a good fucking reason that this is an inborn taboo. It really is genetically a bad idea. Like, incest never once, not even once. People,
yeah, your aunt might look really hot, and yeah, your nephew might have the ass of Kit Harington, but you can't tap that. Nothing good comes from it. Look at the royal family's family tree over in England. It ends badly. It ends with lots of overbites.
All ears and overbites.
And weak chins and mad kings, and it's not good. It's not good. We got to take a firm stand against this. All right, as a society, as a people.
I'm with you. I think the show is telling a fictionalized story with dragons and incest and those types of
things.
I'm saying
it wouldn't surprise me if I found out the HBO executives are all like intermarried and interbred, because this is like the fourth HBO series where some kind of incest family fucking is going on.
Yeah.
And I got my eye on you, HBO. I'm holding the line. No, no incest.
Speaking of being disturbed by this, Tyrion is obviously disturbed by it. And a lot of people are wondering why. The way I read it is this drastically complicates things, both for Dany and Jon, but also for the North and their battle.
It emotionally compromises them.
Yeah.
Like, he just made this big speech about the difference between Dany and you is Dany listens to her trusted advisors. Mm-hmm. Well, now she's getting dicked down by this guy she's already kind of like that. I think that was the exchange that Jorah and Tyrion had, the fact that she's already being swayed and perhaps not doing the smartest thing. Mm-hmm. And now that they're actually in love, that's going to cloud her judgment even more. And I think that a lot of people are like, well, why is Tyrion sweet on Dany? Like, I mean, I would believe it if he was like, look at her, like she's this amazing woman who happens to be super beautiful. Why wouldn't any man like have a crush on her? But I don't think that's what they're going for here.
No, I think
Tyrion is just like, this is politically troubling, and that and he doesn't even know what Bran knows.
It is. It causes people to do irrational things,
right.
and I can see a situation they might be setting up where one of them has to
be sacrificed,
make a stupid play to save the other,
right? And
it costs them
and they can't. Yeah, like someone has to be sacrificed, and there it's going to be the fucking alien covenant situation where,
right,
like they're doing all these stupid fucking things because they're husband and wives. And
yep,
I thought that that's what it was. Now I will say this: the thing I'm bracing for is they seem to be wanting to make this a big deal, like that once. Jon and Dany realize the truth about Jon's, you know, royalty and the fact that their family is going to change everything. It's going to be this big rift. And I don't buy it, man.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, like, if I found out now, 6 years after the fact, that my wife is actually my cousin, I we probably have a good laugh about it, but I'm not going to be like, oh, fuck all this. It's you know, it's all bad. Nothing good can happen of it. Like, I just think I got like, well, that was weird.
You do an HBO show called My Wife Is My Cousin.
I would. It'd be there's probably some kind of story you could tell about a podcaster with a wife who's his cousin. But you know what I'm saying? Like, and also, if you're this power couple, like, who cares who's 1A and 1B? Like, if Dany's going to throw a shit fit that she can't sit the Iron Throne, or Jon, like, suddenly decides that all he wants to do is sit the Iron Throne, I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to buy Dany, like, turning Mad Queen because she finds out that Jon is the rightful heir.
No, I think it's going to be way more of a problem for them politically than it is for their relationship. Hmm. Like, I'm with you. I don't think Dany's going to, like, throw a fit if she realizes, oh, well, Jon's going to be king and I'll be queen, and because, A, I don't even know if that's her goal, right? Her goal is to break the wheel. What does that mean? Might not be king or queen. But also, like, I kind of see them as a team at this point.
Right.
And I think they see themselves that way. They both want the same thing, and however that works out.
And I think Jon would absolutely abdicate the throne if it meant, like,
probably,
he's already bent the knee to her when he didn't, and he was a king in his own right. So, like, it's going to be a big problem for me if they make this a big, like, it can be,
well, it's
like you said, it can be a problem politically for them. It can be a problem and otherwise. It can also just be like a, you know, like a what the fuck kind of thing. But for it to, like, destroy their alliance, which is kind of what I feel like they might be going for, that's going to be a big ask for me.
Actually,
I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I could really see what you just said, which is him saying, I'm okay with just being second banana here. Because I made an oath.
Right.
King, like, I've already promised myself to this queen.
Right.
It doesn't change the fact that I'm a Targaryen. You
right.
know? Like, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because I've made my oath.
This has happened
it.
Before in Targaryen in history where people, you know, were in line and they decided to be passed. I mean, we just talked about in the spoiler section, Aegon the Unlikely, the egg from Duncan Egg, his son abdicated the throne to marry a commoner. Like, it fucking happens.
Yeah.
And it's not a big deal, especially if your wife is actually the undisputed queen. Like, who cares? Right. I hope they don't make this a big deal.
And it'd be such a hypocritical turn for him to say, I have to honor my oath here with Cersei, but I don't have to honor my oath once I find out I'm the king, rightfully.
Right. Yeah.
No, it's not within his character.
Yeah, I every angle I see it from, it's going to be a challenge, and maybe there'll be people whispering in their ears, but I'll be very disappointed if it comes anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we go to Arya and Sansa coming to terms with how they're different, and Sansa compliments Arya, and they repeat their father's words about the lone wolf.
Before we move on, I did
back.
Look up the guy who played Rhaegar was not Harry Lloyd, it's Wilf Scolding.
Yeah, it's another dude who looks a lot like him.
I just think that you just can't pull off the high elven look. That silver hair, braided shit, like, I'm yet to see anybody in Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones that pulls it off. Like, they all look, like, even Orlando Bloom, I always thought there was something off about this long-haired, silver-haired, hippie-looking guy. Like,
it's very unnatural look,
Yeah, it's hard to pull off otherworldly beautiful.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a dude. So.
All right. Want to talk about this Arya and Sansa scene?
Yes, please.
I think it's pretty awesome.
Unless you want to talk more about Kit Harington's ass.
No,
okay,
not really.
Let's move on then.
They come to terms with how they're different, and they compliment each other, and they talk about their father's words about the lone wolf in the pack. And that's really what, you know, won them the day, I think. And they both realize it, and they both realize the ways that they're different and how they can still be together and be who they are.
Yeah, Sansa's "you're very strange and annoying," I thought was perfect.
It was,
the whole Arya starting the quote from her father and Sansa finishing the lone wolf dies but the pack survives, and the fact that they both bond over that they're still grieving for the father, and that Arya now acknowledges that, like, you know, she'd be ill-equipped to deal with what Sansa dealt with, just like Sansa would be ill-equipped to deal with what Arya had to deal with, but they both miss their father and they love them very much.
Right.
And that, you know.
And the family is the bond there.
Yes.
Despite their differences. All right, and then Bran uses the Raven to fly north. I almost said south. And he sees the Night King take down the wall with the White Dragon and march on the north. This is it, man. Oh, fuck, here comes the Night King.
That dragon was fast as shit. Like, I noticed it seemed like he's upgraded because I thought he flew faster than a living dragon.
It's the holes in his wings.
Maybe. It's like tears. A golf ball dimple. It's some aerodynamic shit. I need a NASA engineer to explain it to me. But the other thing is I noticed that dragon doesn't have to stop breathing fire ever.
Seems like it, yeah.
Like Drogon has to at least take a breath, but this guy can just, like, go balls out and destroy a wall without it with one breath, which I thought, boy, on subsequent watches, it seems like he's going to be a handful.
Yep.
If he's an even faster, stronger, more magically potent version of a dragon, then what the hell?
He has the speed and power of two dragons.
Also, the lightning effects they did, where they showed, like, the Army of the Dead just placidly watching it, and, like, all this electric arc energy was, like was reflected on their face. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Night King just never changes expression.
Mm-hmm.
He can be turning a baby. He can be spearing a dragon. He can be destroying a wall, and he just doesn't register on his give-a-fuck meter.
Yeah.
He's just so chill about it. It's very unnerving.
I thought it was pretty excellent to just to hear this horn blow three times.
Yes.
Because of what it means and what you know as a fan it means.
Right. And it's only happened, like, once before in a series at the Fist of the First Men.
Oh, did it happen?
Yeah.
I didn't think it had happened at all.
That they were, like, it's one blast, two blasts, and then three, and it happened. And yeah, I had it in my notes, too, that third horn blast is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Now, can we set – Tormund lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought they made it very clear that there was the men that tried to get down, and they were fucked, and there are the men that just ran, like, west along the wall.
Yeah.
And that they made it because only a very small portion of the wall actually fell.
Yeah.
So I think Tormund's up at the top with Beric looking aghast at this horrifying thing that's happening.
And I guess what they have to do is run to the next castle.
I guess.
And come down that way.
And, like, is the Night King going to, like, treat them the way he did Sam and just kind of, like, as not a threat? Or is he going to hunt? Because the thing is the Night King could just scour every living thing with that dragon. There's nothing they could do about it.
Right.
Although, the other thing is,
I'm assuming this dragon is just as vulnerable to obsidian as any other of the undead or white creatures are.
Probably.
And that's the thing. Like I was talking about in the instant cast about these dragons being glass cannons. They're very risky to put on the battlefield now,
mm-hmm.
because all you need is an archer with an obsidian arrow, and the Night King shit's wrecked. And all the Night King needs is a ice lance, and he can now fire from a fucking dragon like an air to air missile.
Right.
It's like, do you even risk them in battle? Like, what do they do with them now?
Yeah, I think you have to be more strategic with them. But you got to use them in unexpected places.
I know a lot of people are wanting like Drogon just to fucking like do Godzilla versus Mechazilla with this guy, and like that's super cool, but does it make logical sense? I don't know.
I feel like we're gonna see it, whether it makes logical sense or not.
That's how the double D's roll, man.
Because it's just so cool.
They want their zombie polar bear.
Yeah.
They want their dragon versus undragon. They want all those things.
Yep.
And we're probably going to get it.
Let me ask you this: do you think that who do you think is going to make it to Winterfell first, the undead or Dany and Jon?
Undead or Dany or John? Probably Dany or John, because it would be anticlimactic for them to Winterfell be sacked and everyone in there dead.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, if you make it to Winterfell with that dragon, it's over. That's the thing. They don't have dragon glass there.
Did John ship? I'm assuming John shipped the obsidian directly to Winterfell.
Maybe.
Because that's the other thing is people are like, there's a lot of people making these bold statements like, oh, how, you know, that Jon only has X amount of dragon glass and they only have X amount of time. How are they? Like, man, any question that asks anything about quantities or time scales.
Yeah.
I mean, you're setting yourself up for disappointment if you're going to roll your eyes at everyone bristling with dragon glass next season, because it's absolutely going to happen. The double D's, right or wrong, feel like they've told that part of the story. You saw Jon mining for like a couple episodes. They loaded big wooden boxes full of presumably dragon glass onto his boat. The boat has been dispatched. And it's got jet engines on it. Like, everyone that needs dragon glass is going to have dragon glass next season.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. And that's the thing. Like, there is a bit of me that's sad that the tight political thriller that Game of Thrones is largely over, and it's now just going to be fantasy spectacles because it has to be.
That's how stories come to a climax.
Right, and the slow build and like the scheming and all that stuff is large. Like there's one more scheme to be revealed, but you know, I mean, obviously they're not going to be scheming until the finale episode. So
wouldn't think so.
But it is going to be a very different show next season than even this season, because it's all about just resolving all of these plot points. So
yeah, and I feel like I'm okay with that. Like
I
want the setup where it belongs, and I enjoy the setup and the reveals midway through. But eventually, I do kind of want to just, you know, take my hands off the wheel and enjoy the spectacle that must be the finale of this.
I mean, there's a lot of things we can talk about, and I think this will be appropriate conversations, because next week we're coming back to do a wrap-up podcast, and then the week after that we're starting our season 2 coverage. Mm-hmm. So we got lots more Game of Thrones if you're inclined to join us on that journey. But there's a couple things that can be fair to say. For example, the Army of the Dead has largely been this kind of side plot that hasn't really impacted the main plot. It's just always been like this kind of like ticking timepiece.
Mm-hmm.
They're south of the wall now. That can no longer happen.
Yeah.
Every episode we need to know where the fuck they are, what they're doing, and what our heroes are doing. Like, they can no longer be like, oh, well, we're going to show them marching and doing something spooky and transforming a bay like that. They've been dragging their feet that they can no longer do that. They have to make this an actual vital piece of the plot, and it has to be dealt with. So,
although I did think it was kind of hilarious when Jamie was like, our child will never be born if the dead get south of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, they're taking their sweet time. You probably have 9 months.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah, that's the thing, because I've been thinking about, like, what do they do with Cersei? Like, killing a pregnant Cersei. I mean, the show will definitely do that. I've watched the show butcher children, like babies, like in shadow pantomime form. So, like, it's not like they won't do it. But I'm wondering if, like, there'll be this thing where maybe Cersei has a child. And, like, this is an inversion of the last Targaryen rebellion that, you know, Tywin killed
all those babies, make sure there's no heirs, and he had Gregor do it. I wonder if there's going to be a situation where they sack King's Landing. There's now this infant Lannister, and Jaime or John or Danny make the decision to, like, and this is all set up with Theon. Like, you can be a Stark and a, like maybe they do that with Theon. Like, well, we're just going to raise him as our ward.
Yeah.
And, like, just to show that they've really broken the wheel, because this is what happened the last time we had this bloody rebellion. This is now. So I kind of think that there will be a baby that's born.
Yeah,
and it'll have a good end, even if Cersei herself almost surely won't.
That seems fitting.
So, and maybe that's another way that Danny and John can have a child together.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's that, and that'd be bittersweet too.
Yeah.
Like
adopted, you know, forcibly adopted.
yeah, I guess. Well, killed your mom.
Yeah.
Welcome to the family, kid. So those are some things I had. Those are some thoughts I had coming out of this.
Cool. Well, that's it for the recap. Before we move on to feedback, this podcast is actually sponsored by a company called Bombfell, which I've actually used before they even sponsored us. I heard about it, I think, on another podcast.
Sounds like the more explodey version of Winterfell.
Some might say that, but others might say it's a company focused on making getting good clothes easier for men. Because I don't know about you, but I'm not the world's biggest fan of going clothes shopping. I do a lot of my purchases online. And it's kind of just like a crapshoot for the most part where, you know, I go, I see a shirt I like. I'm like, I guess I'm a large. I'm somewhere between a medium and a large. So fuck me. How am I going to get my clothes that fit well? The thing I like about Bombfell the most is that they actually pair you up with a personal stylist. And you go through the sign-up process, which costs nothing. It's not like, this is not a monthly subscription type thing. You can get clothes as frequently or infrequently as you want. You go through the process and they ask you a whole bunch of questions, like obviously your weight, your height. They kind of ask like where your weight sits on you, like is it in your stomach, is it in your hips, is it in your nose? I don't know.
All in the crotch.
Well, that's what I put. They wrote back and said, please, sir, please be serious for a second.
This is crucial to your proper fit.
I wrote back. I said, no, all in the crotch. And they just sent me pants that were way too huge. And then I was like, fine. Okay.
Yeah, you did it to yourself.
I did. But no, that you work with a personal stylist and they answer a whole bunch of questions about, you know, what styles of clothes you like. I'm very much like a flannel type guy, so I got a whole bunch of those. And then they cater orders to what they think you would like based on that information. And then they send you, you can pick like a budget that you'd like to stick within. So like, let's say, you know, this week I'm looking for some business clothes or some casual clothes or whatever. That kind of fit within $100 max on a nice flannel shirt or a nice button up or something. Or you can set it for $50. You can set it for $300. You know, they can meet any budget really, and send you clothes catered to that.
What if you were a queen that has $100,000 Dothraki that you need to buy warm weather gear for? Is there some kind of discount code or some kind of special offer she could take advantage of to save a couple gold dragons?
I mean, definitely. I don't know what, you know, the bulk orders look like. I've never really done the 100,000 Dothraki rider order. They have it. It's an option. You can check it out. But yeah,
and you know, every one of those dudes going to claim it's all the weights in the waist.
All in the crotch, yeah.
Yep.
No, you can get $25 off your first purchase by visiting bombfell.com/GOT. And it's actually, if you don't know how to spell that, it's bombfell.com. It's bombfell.com/GOT. Yeah, and you can save $25 off your first purchase. I've been really impressed with the quality of the clothes. I've never had clothes that have fit me so well, A, because I've never had like this custom tailored experience, and B, I've never had clothes that have felt as good as these, because I picked a modest budget. I picked like, I think $100 on the flannel shirts I got. They sent me something in the like 80 to 90 range. I'm super happy with them. And the experience is very, very simple. What they do is you say, hey, I want this budget and I want these style of clothes. They pick out an order for you and they give it to you 48 hours before they ship it. And they say, here's what we're going to ship. And then you go online and you say, I don't know if I like this one, replace it with something else. And they'll do that within that 48-hour window. Or you can just say, yep, like them all, ship it now. They send it to you, you try them on, they send the shipping container to send it all back. If you don't like any of it, you can keep whatever you do like, and you only get charged for the pieces that you keep. So if you get a pair of jeans and a flannel and a belt, and you say, well, I only like the jeans because all my weight's in the crotch and you guys did me a service, you can send the flannel and the belt back. You only pay for the jeans. So it's really super easy and convenient. And I don't know about you, but I hate going to stores and like trying stuff on and all that stuff. I'd rather do it at home. This makes it super easy. Go to bombfell.com/GOT and get $25 off your first purchase.
Hey, I want to take a quick break to talk about a sponsor for our podcast, Sonos. Mm-hmm. Sonos.
And I've heard of them.
Yeah, and so I gushed about them on the spoiler podcast last week.
You did a terrible job explaining exactly what they were up front, though.
Did I?
Noticed that. So why don't you tell people what Sonos is?
Sonos is a wireless sound system
uh-huh.
that you've got. They got various different sizes. They got, like, I got shipped a play bass, a sub, and, or no, a bass, or is it a play bass?
I think it's play bass. Yeah.
Play bass, a sub, and a play. Mm-hmm. Or two plays.
Two play ones.
Two play ones. And you can, they got different sets of speakers, but essentially you can configure these in different ways. Like I got mine set up where the sound bass is kind of like a sound bar your TV can sit on. Mm-hmm. And it's like your essentially your center channels. And I got a subwoofer hooked up to that. It provides a lot of punch. And I got the other speakers throughout the house, and you can set these like different meshes up. Like you can have all of the speakers playing throughout the hall, all the house. As one, or you can set them up like a 5-1 sound system, or you can have different things playing in different rooms, and the software makes it really easy and quick to set up and do that. But I was curious about your experience, because you got these things drop shipped the day after I did, and you set them all up over the weekend. What'd you think?
I actually watched the Game of Thrones finale with these things
Me
on
too.
In 5.1 configuration, and I gotta say it was pretty badass.
Yeah,
like the. I'm totally not used to the 5.1 experience,
right?
Because I've been listening just on weak TV speakers the whole time,
right.
But I'm totally sold on it now because like you can hear everything happening all around you. I mean, it's the definition of 5.1, right? But when like there are dragons flying around and screeching and flying across the screen, you can hear it all. I was blown away.
Yeah, and the other thing I saw is there's a feature that you can like turn on like a dialogue emphasizing mode where it makes the, because that's one thing I've always struggled with is, you know, when like you got a special effects heavy mix, like picking out the dialogue, and it like just punches up the like the speech frequencies, I guess. It's essentially black magic, mm-hmm. like the wireless technology itself. It just works. Like it's noticeable as soon as you turn it on. Everything, the speech becomes so much easier to hear. But
I know you already commented on this last time because mm-hmm. you had set yours up. I hadn't. Mm-hmm. When I set mine up, it was super easy to do.
Right.
Like you literally just plug them in, you download the app, and it walks you through the whole process. And it's right. not a very long process.
No.
It's like not complicated.
The longest part is typing in your overly complicated Wi-Fi password if it's anything like mine.
Right.
And you have to do
mine
that
too.
Once because every speaker that you add to the mesh, they just get the configuration from each other.
Yeah.
So
no,
it's only
really
the one time you just keep adding. And that's the other thing that's not a pain in the ass is – you know, setting up a 5.1 or 7 whatever can involve like running wires through your floor, you know, wall, or you have them dangling on the floor and it's a pain. This is all wireless. You have to have power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yep.
So we both think Sonos is great. And for the first time ever, they're offering listeners of our Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. All you got to do is use the promo code GOT-10. That's capital G, capital O, capital T, 10 at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcasts will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do we have any feedback to do?
Oh boy, do we. Start right off, David C. When responding to some feedback in your last podcast, you guys mentioned that you really don't care or think it makes a difference whether Dragon was killed as a white or a white walker. The one area I think it makes a huge difference is the matter in which how you'd kill it. If it's a white, one of the two living dragons would just torch it. But if it's a white walker, then it'd take a dragon glass or, assuming Valyrian steel, to kill it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I think it would be interesting to see Dany kind of invert that, where she's got an obsidian spear that she brings down the Night King dragon. That'd be a good way to go. But I don't know. I also think, because here's the other thing about a lot of people emailed and said, I didn't like undead Viserion taking down the wall because presumably he has ice breath and that. And also, it is a little bit of a violation of the duality where they say, you know, the fire magic consumes and destroys and the ice magic preserves. How in the hell did ice breath dragon tear down the wall? But
I'm not totally convinced that it's ice breath. Like, I don't know what it is.
It's some kind of magical thing.
Yeah.
And, like, I think you just have to accept that we don't understand how it works. And I wish it was otherwise, because we talked about this a lot on the podcast over the years, that the longer you go without revealing the bedrock mechanical principles of a magical system, the more the writers are going to be tempted to ass-pull things and deus ex machina the thing up. Mm-hmm. Aaron B., a lot of criticisms I heard in the podcast for the last 2 weeks are about people making poor decisions that are not super logical or people saying something that seems dumb. As a clinical psychologist, I feel the need to remind everyone that people are not always or even usually logical.
But we're not talking about the real world, for God's sake. We're talking about storytelling.
That's the thing. Like, this
is where I get hung up on this stuff.
Right. And they analogize.
If your point of telling the story the way that you're telling it is to say, hey, people are dumb and they don't always make perfect decisions.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
But if you're trying to tell an interesting and clever story and you're not even thinking about that stuff, you need to make your story interesting and clever.
Yeah, I mean, because that's just essentially like the Attack of the Clones. Like, well, Anakin's dialogue to Padme wasn't terrible. It's just he's a teenager and he says stupid stuff. Like, well,
that's not why
this isn't
happens.
Wet, hot American summer. Like, there's different things that you do with different shows. Part of the fiction is the pleasure of watching smart people do smart things and
And even the, you know, quote unquote dumb ones get punted. But like, you know, they've established these characters, except for maybe Cersei, as not being particularly stupid. So we don't like seeing them see, even though it's entirely human. It's entirely like it's real life. But this is not real life. This is called fantasy.
Yeah.
And that's part of the fantasy. So, yeah, I agree with you, and the rest of the email is essentially that, so we can move on.
Okay.
Will A. says, I seem to remember you criticizing Benjen's decision to not get on the horse with John. My impression from Benjen's facial expression is that he was aware that he had time to get on the horse, but instead chose not to. This could have been for many reasons, such as giving his fairly lonely life a meaningful end. And that that's what the Double D's all that said in the behind the scenes of that episode. I don't think they sold it on camera.
No, I wasn't thinking that when I watched it.
I mean, he could even said like, but he could have said there's, he could have not said there's no time.
This is how I go.
He could be like, you know, no, this is
it for me.
This is what I want.
Yeah.
I've been like, there's a way you could tell that story. And I felt like that they just didn't do enough to tell it.
Yeah.
And it's also in one of those things where if that was the only thing in an episode was bullshit, fine, but there was a lot more than that one thing that was bullshit, and that's the theory of suspension of disbelief. Once it falls, it fucking falls. Like, it just, like, you're calling bullshit on everything. Miguel Sapochnik, and or he goes, his formula for fixing season 8 is Miguel Sapochnik and lots of him. Actually, just give him the whole season. I'll sacrifice no ghost in season 8 for his visual mastery. I think I read that Miguel, who did such a great job in the Battle of the Bastards. Didn't he do Battle of the Bastards? I know he did Hard Home for a fact.
Yeah.
That there was a scheduling deal. It's not like they didn't want him, that he was working on some other project. So I think, yeah, he's awesome. He should definitely be in part of the all-star directors that I hope they get for it, but we'll see. And also, I no longer feel that this season was something on the brink. I don't think it's the strongest season of Game of Thrones by any stretch, but it's certainly not the worst.
No.
I think season 5 still holds that crown.
Yeah.
Dave, and even then, they're talking like a B season. What would you give this season letter grade wise?
Probably a B sounds about right. B plus. Yeah.
I think the finale is the difference between a B and
it was.
Yeah.
Between a B and like a C.
Yeah.
C
yeah, yeah,
minus.
Yeah. Yeah. David P. People have been wondering about the Dothraki that invaded Westeros with Dany. What happens if Dany dies? Well, in season 6, episode Blood of My Blood, Dany names her entire Khalasar as her blood riders. When a Khal dies, his blood riders die with him so they can ride together in the Nightlands. If this bittersweet ending is true, and if Dany ends up dying to Battle of the Dawn, could the Dothraki kill themselves to join her? Is it known? I'm pretty sure Khal Drogo's blood riders, like, boned off and started some of their own Khalasars. Like, I didn't think, so that might be, like, a guideline more than a hard and fast rule.
Yeah.
So, do I want to see 100,000 dudes mass commit suicide because...
Right into the ocean or something?
Right, right. I don't know. The other thing is, So I thought this would be a huge logistical plot point, but it seems that they're just going to have the Dothraki right up there.
Up to Winterfell?
They're going
to
have 100,000 Dothraki they put in parkas
that
have come from where?
Like, hey, man, I've long questioned where the hell Dany's getting her clothes from. The Dothraki are just an extension.
Well, Dany's one thing; she can afford but the getting 100,000 Dothraki and their horses outfitted to survive a harsh winter condition.
No, like they're already worried about the food. I guess Winterfell's the place to be, right? They're going to gather up all the grain from the north and store it.
Yeah, right.
So I guess that's a place to be, but yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah,
where do they get all the furs?
They're just not equipped with, and neither are the Unsullied. They're all kind of warm weather fighters. So I don't know. I wonder if they'll be like, because that's kind of the tale of the American Revolution. You know, you always get the story of the dudes wrapping their feet in newspaper because they don't have there's no cloaks, and they're like literally freezing and starving, and George Washington's keeping together by, you know, just by the sheer will of his personality. I wonder if they'll go. Like some of that revolutionary stuff will work its way into the plot. That like it is like the Dothraki are miserable,
yeah,
and
can imagine
not as effective as they would be, but they love Dany or afraid of her or worship her or whatever. Eric R. I was waiting until Sunday's episode aired in the States to ask this question, but what does the future hold for the lineage of dragons? I fired up the Google machine, was able to get some consistent answers that hinted that dragons can be hermaphroditic. Which I've heard you discuss on the show, this based on Maester Aemon's ambiguous account of dragon reproduction. Can they also be asexual, or do you need two to tango, so to speak? If it's the latter, then if I were Danny, I'd bust out the oysters and chocolates, light some candles, get one of them dragons to flip the female switch so I can get some dragon eggs stat. Mm-hmm. Another one of these guys falls, she's done with dragons forever, right? Why wouldn't they already be working on a cave full of eggs somewhere just in case? Aren't 50 dragons better than three? Do you have any insights into Game of Thrones dragon reproduction?
I don't know what their, you know, the society for dragons and their mothers looks like, but right. It's a little weird when, I don't know, if your mom came up to you and said, hey, you need to start banging. You need to start banging somebody here.
Sure.
You got a girlfriend. You just do it. Do
say,
it.
Look, I'm. Do you think I want to fuck my nephew?
Right.
Well, times are tough. Times are tough for us Targaryens.
It's not just a suggestion. I'm going to watch you do it, and it's going to need to happen today.
This email reminds me of like the whole deal of trying to get pandas to breed in captivity that they like tried. Like, I'm not even making this up. Panda porn.
Right.
You know, like some real kinky shit.
Yeah, turns out just the pandas bamboo are in the whips and all chains the holes. And,
yeah. Yeah, your urethral stimulation, it's just crazy. Sounding, it's crazy. But yeah, I don't think anyone knows. And the thing is like, how do dragon genetics work? Because I think that you would call these dragons functionally extinct. Mm-hmm. Because if they reproduce asexually, fine, I guess. They just clone each other. But if they have to have sexual reproduction, this is a shallow-ass gene pool. Like, you can get, like, if you have the last two of a living animal today, you're fucked because there's no way to get them enough genetic diversity to where they'll thrive as a species.
Maybe there are some leftover eggs out in old Valyria.
I mean, that's the thing. There's like, fossilized eggs are a thing. In the books,
I mean, that's what she had essentially.
In
right?
the books, like, Euron has claimed to have one, and he just tossed it in the sea because that's how Euron rolls, man. He's the guy that, like, you know, snorts cocaine through a $100 bill and then lights his doobie with it. You know, It's like he just does. That's how much he doesn't give a fuck. He's just throwing dragon eggs into the sea.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's keeping it for a dragon army that's because he's going to asexual reproduce them. And I don't know. No one knows. No one knows.
But it's a good point. Like, she should be thinking about that, but clearly she doesn't want to consider that she might herself be killed and she needs a successor or that any more of her dragons
What's
are
crazy
die.
Is, like, it's so stupid to say that no one knows because there's got to be tomes and tomes of information about dragons in the 200 years they were in Westeros at the Maester's catalog.
For sure.
Like, so someone knows.
That King's Landing.
And that's frustrating that
Maester was studying those fucking dragons.
Right.
For sure.
Right. Like, maybe they're working for their downfall, which is a popular theory, but they sure as hell were cataloging, like, you know, how often. So, it's frustrating, but, I mean, literally, we don't. And also, if you found a bunch of fossilized eggs, was that a one-time magical thing that Danny did to pay for death for life?
Maybe. Throw them into fire and see.
Is that why she can have kids now? Because one of her children died last episode?
Maybe.
Started up the whole works again?
I don't know.
All right. Simon from England. I'm assuming it's Simon Pegg.
Okay.
I'm well on board with your prediction of a parliamentary democracy as an endpoint for the story, but how can you have this if one person's holding all the military power? Therefore, all dragons must die, right? I predict in the final epic dragon battle, the ice dragon, Drogon, and the other dragon Jim doesn't care about toast each other. What do you think?
What other dragon I don't care about? There's Drogon, and then there's the other two.
Rhaegal?
Yeah.
That's
I don't care about either of the other two.
I think you're actually right, Simon. I do think that all the dragons will die, because I think what this is a story, just like Lord of the Rings, where this is like the last gasp of the magical things before they shuffle off into obscurity, before the Shire just becomes rural England.
Yeah.
So I think that... I do think that... you can have a benevolent dictator that would use these dragons in a forthright manner, but that's the whole deal about breaking the wheel, because you die, and what happens when Cersei's bastard child that you've raised as your own after you killed her, it turns out that all the Lannisters are genetically bad people.
Yeah.
They got an evil gene in them that skipped Tyrion and Jaime.
Tommen and Myrcella, had they lived, would have been terrible.
They would have been shits, too, sure. Like, that's the thing. So I do think that the dragons will die and that the Night King will be utterly defeated and there will be essentially no more magic in the land.
So Bran's visions are just going to
go away? Yeah, that might be how Bran knows his mission is complete, that, like, the green sight and the war just goes away.
Huh.
what did you do in Winterfell, Bran, or Three-Eyed Raven? I became Bran Stark.
And then the Three-Eyed Raven sold him a load of goods because he can't even fly anymore.
Right.
You can't walk, but you will fly. Timber, and then you go back to very much not walking. he's in a wheelchair now. He's cool.
The last gasp of magic is Bran gets the use of his legs back.
No, he'll found the Paralympics.
There you go.
He'll get all the paraplegics from Essos and Westeros together. It'll be a East versus West kind of thing. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Be cool. I'll watch Bran play.
That's the spinoff.
Paraplegic basketball. Or I guess they joust, wouldn't they? They'd all get those fancy weird saddles and they'd joust and...
Probably just do all the regular sports except
Tyrion will full-time make prosthetics for the crippled children of the world so they can compete in the para Westerosi games.
Get fucking Maester Wolkin to do it. Apparently he can whip something up in seconds.
And that wheelchair is pretty tight.
It's badass. It's
very well engineered.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Kara L. Something I saw in the Making of the Frozen Lake scene extra. I guess I'm the only one who watched that, because where's the rage about the Double D's throwing a fit for 4 seasons about getting denied to polar bear zombies and then finally saying, we're doing it whether you like it or not? Are you kidding me? So much time and money and effort went into that drawn-out scene that had no real point other than they wanted a stupid CGI bear. And then it goes into, I can't believe we're getting that instead of Ghost. I think she has a point.
But we have to allow them their indulgences. Like, if it's going to keep them engaged.
But we can also bitch that, like, we'd trade 10 polar bears for one ghost.
Sure. And I think you're well within your rights to be annoyed by it. But also, like, if I'm making the show, I want to do some fun things for myself as well as for the audience. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe it's a bit much to do a 5-minute interview where you're gloating about it. And I do think that in season 8, a reunion we absolutely need to have is John and fucking Ghost. Like,
they
we cannot not see Ghost for the rest of the season.
I'm with you. We have to have at least one more Ghost appearance, sort of like we got with Nymeria. If I were the Double D's, I would play it like, we actually didn't realize that anybody wanted to see Ghost.
Yeah.
Like, we just thought everybody was over Ghost. We're kind of over Ghost. So we just didn't do him. But yeah, we can totally put him
like
in season 8.
I feel like I'm Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. It's like, okay, you guys need to make some polar bear zombies. Need to make some ice dragons. Then do it, because I want my Ghost. So putting you guys on record.
Ghost will be back. Mark
does it say dead Ghost storage out front of my house? No, it does not. I need to see him. Jennifer P., some info. We might have gotten a spit take there. So close.
It was close.
I just need a little bit more next time.
Yeah.
Jennifer P., some info pertinent to your discussion from Beyond the Wall podcast regarding Martin's involvement in the show. There was a big fucking to-do in the fandom because George Martin had hinted that he doesn't even watch Game of Thrones, and he quickly came out and did an interview with EW. He goes, no, I totally watch Game of Thrones. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's just not my thing. It's weird. I do think that it's still kind of their relationship has gotten weirder ever since he stopped writing episodes and stopped it's his magnum opus that these guys have kind of stolen from him.
Well, and, that he's handed.
No,
to
I
them
get it.
And,
that's
right.
I feel like I've given the other side of story enough
totally.
That like from George, like this is. I mean, he has no one to blame for himself. Like, can he force creativity? Creative people differ, but the fact is he didn't do it, and that's got to be. That's got to be hard. Like, I would be super pissed if let's say if I lost my voice and you did the finale of season of Game of Thrones and, like, all of Bald Move without me from there that point on. Like, I might be happy for you and, like, all that, but still, at the end of the day, I would want the guy to be there too, right? So, like, just on a purely selfish level, he's got to be bummed that this has been taken from him.
But would you listen to the podcast?
No.
Okay. Well, there you go. George isn't watching.
No, because I would just be impotently saying all the things I want to say and no voice is coming out. Why would I torture myself that way? Brendan, in my view... Okay, so this is on to the new stuff. In my view, season 7 was a significant step down in quality from previous seasons. And I'm going to essentially take two readers or two listeners as a pro and con and to kind of speak for all the different listeners that wrote in.
Okay.
This is the minority view. I'd say 15% have this kind of take. In my view, season 7 is a significant step down in quality from previous seasons. Perhaps I'm a tough audience, as I'm a frequent rewatcher of all episodes in seasons past, but I really feel like we as fans deserve more attention to detail and more reverence for the build-up of this epic story than we have enjoyed over the past 6 or so years. putting aside jetpacking issues, D-plus plots, and B-minus execution, and other smaller confusions you guys and other fans have pointed out this season, I feel like there's just been a general sense of anticlimactic handling of a lot of moments that should have been more sweetly satisfying. A fresh example that's on my mind, after everything Littlefinger has been responsible for and involved in over the years, we get 5.5 minute scene for his comeuppance. We get 8 or so precious, this is almost the end of the series, minutes of Theon's latest identity crisis, but 5 measly minutes for the greatest schemer of Westeros finally answering for his crimes. I could go on ad nauseum with other examples, but I'd need more time and more alcohol. I'll still watch the show, you're right, but right now I've lost a lot of confidence that this final season will deliver, and that makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and try and, you know, pick apart every little thing of every little scene, but to me, it hasn't felt right. Like that.
And I do agree that we probably deserve more attention to detail.
Sure, yeah.
But how long has George been working on wrapping this thing up? 7 years and counting, right? 6 yeah. years and counting. The Double D's did it in 12 months. Mm-hmm. And they had no other choice. They could not, like, go off air. I mean, that for many, many, many reasons, that's not an option. But, you know, this thing about Littlefinger, like, Ned got, what, 5? I mean, like, I'm thinking of, like, when they led Ned to the executioner's thing and cut his head off, what was that? A few minutes, couple minutes, 5 minutes? Like, why should, and Rob, like, the Red Wedding, when it finally turned, like, I mean, what did you want from Littlefinger? Like a trial by combat? Like how much did you want to stretch this out? He was at the end of his story, and his story ended abruptly, like so many have done. Like Margaery got exploded,
right?
You know, true. That whole thing took up a whole episode, but I don't know. Like,
I just never felt, I guess, the feeling you're describing, like I was getting shortchanged on important events and characters.
And I guess I didn't have a did you have a preconceived notion of how Littlefinger should go out?
No.
Because I mean,
aside from Arya taking his face, like that was my pet theory.
Which is still on the table.
Even barring, well, I suppose so, yeah, she could grab that face off the ground.
Right.
But even barring that, I never, like during that scene, felt like, well, this is okay, but I wish it was more. I wish there was something extra.
I don't.
I felt like this is maybe the most appropriate way it could go, because Littlefinger will, if you give him the opportunity, weasel out of it. And so it was a short scene by necessity, because they were just there to do one thing, which is execute Littlefinger.
It seems like some of the fans did think that Littlefinger was like going to be the exception, that he was going to play it smart and have all of his options all the way through. But I feel like they were been telling a story of a man who and that's the thing, like, he told Cersei knowledge is power, and then I forget what she did, but she like did this demonstration where she could have him killed. She goes, no, actually, power is power. And I feel like that's Littlefinger's story. He didn't have any actual power other than the schemes that he had, and those schemes, in the beginning, he had so many options and so many things to turn against each other, and he just slowly ran out, and he put all of his eggs. He even said as much in one scene, that he's essentially put all of his chips in this one basket, and there's only, you can't pivot. Like, this isn't a Saturday afternoon matinee villain who could twirl his mustache and take off in a helicopter from the top of Winterfell and fight. And he's not fucking Dr. Wily or Dr. Eggman from Sonic the Hedgehog. He will be defeated. And I guess think about, like, what did you want? I mean, the matter of fact, cutting off, like, the fact that Arya killed him in a way that robbed him of his speech, like, that's, to me, it's very much like I said, Saruman getting thrown off the Dark Tower. It's, fitting.
I did too, and I think the sentiment that I agree with is that this season has been lacking in the details and the connective tissue that have made Game of Thrones so rich in the past.
Right.
Which I definitely felt, and I totally agree with that.
Right.
I just don't think, like, when they went for these big moments that they ever kind of missed the mark.
And that's the thing. I think that first paragraph explains, like, if you are of the mind that, like, you just genuinely think that this isn't as well thought out and exquisitely scripted, because it's not. It's just not. Then that's going to color your impression of things. Like, you're going to feel like no matter what you get, like, the fact of that it's probably not as good as what George can come up with. Because there's a thread on Reddit where it's like what we already knew before the show told us, and they talked about all the different hints that
that not only John wasn't a bastard, but he was actually the rightful king. And a lot of that I didn't even pick up on. Like, George is really good at weaving this shit in and making it obvious in retrospect. And that's just not something you can do when you got a 8-month development cycle.
Right.
That's one of the reasons I think the Double D's are taking a year and a half off so they can. Like, I think this kind of scared them. Like, shit, even with 7 episodes, we didn't come up with stuff that we were necessarily super proud of. Let's take more time to get it right. So.
And the one, I just thought of one scene where I sort of agree that it got shortchanged and it was a big moment that should have had more impact. That's the reunion of Jaime and Tyrion.
Yeah.
I think that moment, for the sake of moving the plot forward, got shortchanged. I definitely felt that one.
Yeah, but I also felt like in real life they would not keep Cersei waiting either.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to bandy words outside her chamber door, you know.
Maybe so, but I, as a fan, was hoping for more. And they left me wanting.
All right, Christine McSee has the opposite view. I feel like the showrunners gambled on hitting the emotional notes perfectly without worrying about satisfying strict factual scrutiny. And it worked. Give me all the jetpacking, mysterious ice, magic flame, whatever from the White Dragon, as long as I get to see Sansa pull the rug out from Littlefinger, both Lannister brothers having a moment of utter belief that they were about to die at Cersei's hands, and Cersei then Jaime clearly shitting their pants over the white attack / white force numbers. Yeah, that's something I think... we didn't talk about Jaime almost dying in the main cast, probably because we talked about it a lot on the instant cast.
Yeah.
But I utterly thought that he was going to die. And then here's the difference. A lot of shows will pull this bullshit, and in retrospect, there is no reason it shouldn't have happened. But I was utterly convinced he's going to die, and then when it didn't happen, I utterly believed that Cersei just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because I do think there is something in her, still in her vestigial heart, that won't let her pull the trigger. And and the conflict on her face, because Lena Headey was brilliant in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the conflict on her face as Jaime marched away, like, she was torn between having Sir Gregor go over there and lop his head off and letting him go and making him come back. And, like, it's a great scene.
Yeah.
She continues, I feel like the show played to consistent themes throughout the episode. Leaders choosing whether to spout expedient lies, family choosing to work together or betray each other, heroes choosing between loyalty and humanity, and of course, the triumph of the cockless. And I totally agree that those the themes about leadership and politics and families and what that means, that were brilliantly juxtaposed in this season.
Yeah.
And to good effect. Toby K, which I can only assume is Toby Keith.
It is, yeah.
Yep.
I talked to my good buddy Toby. He wrote in and he said he was going to write us a country song, but we actually already have a song to play. If you guys didn't stick around to the end of this episode, because a fan, Blade Gear, yes, that's his real name, badass name, by the way, actually wrote a song that he wants us to play, that he offered to let us play on the show, and I accepted. It's kind of a takedown of the Ed Sheeran thing. You know how everybody was like, oh, fuck Ed Sheeran, and we don't want him on the show.
He won a VMA, I hear.
Yeah.
Kendrick Lamar, it's an outrage.
Was it for the song
Taylor
that he sung?
Beyonce, yet again.
Oh, okay. I thought it was for Game of Thrones.
No.
Yeah, he wrote a song based on that whole thing, and we're going to play it at the very end of this show. So stick around to the end of feedback, because I think it'll be awesome.
I'm looking forward to Toby Keith's remix of Boot in Your Ass, Westeros style. Put a dragon flame up your ass or something. I don't know. This is why I'm not a country music star. Anyway, Toby Keith says, hey, I wonder if you guys would consider looking into the spoilers or leaks after the episode and maybe covering them in your show. In other words, I've avoided them like the plague, and I'm actually a little curious about exactly what plot points were the ones that leaked. Anyway, love you guys. Keep up the good work. No.
It's everything. It's all of it.
And there's also, I was shocked because I actually sat and was going, because I was confident because all of the podcaster friends that have read it let me know that it's like, because here's what happened. These leaks came out like almost 12 months ago. And then as filming progressed, people were like, oh, well, Gendry is supposed to come back, and here we see him in this scene. Oh, this is the Isle. Like, people were just, like, putting all these details together. Oh, here is Davos and Tyrion on the beach, and we're seen through our binoculars. Like, it wasn't just the leaks. It was the fact that they had the leaks, and then they could – most of these shots are outdoors. Anything that's shot outdoors, people can just camp out and see with telephoto lenses. And they utterly proved almost everyone. There was 2 points that didn't make it in that they might be saving for next season, or they might be stuff they just chose not to go with when they, you know, because they go from like coming up with this stuff to breaking it down.
And if you want to find it, search for like Game of Thrones season 7 spoilers Reddit, and you will come to the thread of like the first result where they do this, and someone went and took all the plot points and all the pictures, and but it's everything. They knew everything, like the White Dragon being turned, Cersei's false alliance that she betrayed, like every single point, Gendry coming back, Sansa and Arya's beef, Littlefinger dying, every major plot point, and they're just little bullet points, and I feel sorry.
The one I'm glad they didn't go with is where Jon does the helicopter before Dany makes love to him.
Oh.
I'm real glad they didn't include that. Also, the one where Littlefinger, Littlefinger does the helicopter too before he dies. So it's really weird. They took those both out. I'm really glad they did.
I actually feel sorry for people that because that's got to be the worst way to get those points.
Like, yeah, I want to see it unfold on the screen. I don't want to read about it in some text document posted on Pastebin. Like, fuck that, man.
Yeah, like I mean to have all the artistry and artifice stripped away and just to read. A blind plot point, like let me give you one here. Bullet point: Viserion is killed and raises a Night King's mount.
Wow,
that's plot point. Episode 7: Sansa. Bullet point: Sansa sentences Littlefinger to death, which Arya carries out. You know,
yeah.
Tyrion takes a moment to talk to Cersei alone after Dragon Pit parlay, like. I mean, that's the worst way to get this stuff. And I really, really hope people, if this happens again, I really hope people, and I know there'll be at least a few people, but like, I really hope the people that are bummed out about the season and who did take advantage of spoilers, they learn. And if those things come out next year, just refrain. Just wait. There's only so much more Game of Thrones we're going to get. Don't spoil yourself with us so close to the finish line.
Yeah, I'm so glad I waited.
And I hope there's no spoilers because it's also just made speculation impossible.
Yeah.
Because, like, again, like everyone cries innocence when I accuse them of it. But I know the difference between someone saying, like, oh, what do you think of an ice dragon will be? And, like, someone's particularly say, what about this ice dragon? Do you think you'll be able to destroy the wall?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's the thing, like... It made it hard to, like, anyone, someone started engaging in speculation, I just skipped the email because, like, well, how the hell am I going to know? And, you know, it's just like, it was a real bummer all around, and I don't see the obvious benefit. Like, the obvious benefit is you get to know the plot, but just the plot.
You get to feel special.
It's literally what people scream about. Like, don't spoil me, bro. But people are going out and seeking it. Like,
yeah.
It'd be one thing if you could get, like, a leak copy, I get. Because that's the whole enchilada.
I feel like
and you're just waiting for HBO to decide to give it to you.
They're looking for the feeling that the book readers had for the first 5 seasons, right?
But that's the
of
thing.
Like, hey, I know what's coming, and it's going to be awesome, and you don't.
That book was a work of art. It wasn't just the you know this.
I know it's like the artifice of that feeling, but it is that feeling.
Yeah,
that's what people are seeking, I think.
Yeah, it's a bummer. I hope it doesn't happen next time.
Yeah.
Cody S., do you think a lot of hate for the show now is stemming from the tonal shift? Until now, the show has been a lot of political intrigue and character-building adventures, but now this is the end. The only real schemer left... Oh, by the way, if you don't want to remain spoiled, do not do what I did and go out and read those bullet points, because there are a couple that did not make it in the season, like one or two, but they're kind of big ones.
Yeah.
So, could be something they decide not to do, could be something that's going to happen early next season. Stay the fuck away. Do you think a lot of hate for the show now is stemming from the tonal shift? Up until now, the show has been a political intrigue and character-building adventure, but now this is the end, and the only real schemer left is Baelish, R.I.P., who has resorted to meddling with teen sisters. The only human villain left is Cersei, and we all think she's going to die. All the characters have reached the peak of their growth, and for the most part, the fantasy elements that were non-existent in Season 1 are now in full force with rings, dragons, zombies, relics, magic... All the show has left is a fantastical, fictional final battle left played or based on unrealistic magical rules and maybe a few gut-punch deaths. Do you think this is the cause of so much displeasure to many?
Yeah, totally.
Yep.
That's exactly it.
Yep.
People bought in for a thing, and they didn't realize that at some point it has to become a different thing.
I do think it's not the whole explanation, because I've seen plenty of things wrapped up where everyone's like, I'm totally satisfied.
Yeah.
So I do think... they are missing the mark. I think there's reasons for that. I think they're human reasons that anyone that has an ounce of charity can understand. And it's a bummer that it's happening this way, but it is. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see 2 years from now whether people are like, did the Double D succeed or not?
And then if they succeed or fail, the an interesting question becomes, can George do it better?
Right.
Or will George do it at all?
And we're not... Do you think there might be any politics left in this show? Or do you think it is just all battle? Like, I know we continue to say, like, it's just coming down to this big battle, but the main villain hasn't been dealt with yet, and I don't think it's the Night King. I think it's Cersei.
I think the political scheming... So this is, you're asking me, and I, this is my first thought. I actually think there might be some political scheming, but it's going to be amongst the enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Cersei is overly trusting Euron and thinks that he is hot for her in a way that I don't think he is.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's expedient, and the fact that I think there's a little, there's more truth than Cersei be comfortable admit when he looked at Dany and said, "I suggest you go back to the island. We sit out this winter, and then, you know, we see what happens in the spring."
Uh-huh.
Like, I think that it's highly likely that Euron's going to take Cersei's gold, buy the army, and you're going to come back, and you know, Euron sitting on the throne,
right?
And Cersei's into black cells or something. I don't know. But that's...
I'm just saying, oh, we can't see any twists, so there aren't any twists left. Yeah. It's probably pretty short-sighted because we didn't see a lot of the twists to begin with, you know?
The other thing would be satisfying for me is if Tyrion does devise, like, the mother of all political traps for Cersei that she blunders into.
Right.
That, like, he finally is like, well, I tried to fight it this way. And, like, and also the fact that they were the last stand against extinction of humanity is going to buy them the clout to, like, fuck over. Because the other thing is, I also don't think they sold the fact that Cersei has to be deeply unpopular in her realm. Like, she's like essentially the, you know, like an Italian governor that killed the Pope, mm-hmm, and torched the Vatican, and the people are just like cool with that. Like, there's no grumbling, yeah, about that. And they're also low-key, no food, no money, no soul. Like, they haven't told that part of the story very, very well either. Like, what, like, mm-hmm, that's always the pot boiler. Like, the fact that the small people, the small folk, they have all the power because there's a lot more of them. And if they get pissed off, they can raise up. And that's definitely been downplayed this season. But, yeah, I don't think it's, I think it's dismissive of the people that are not happy and not fair to them to say it's just because they don't understand that this is essentially, we're moving on to the epilogue part of the series, because there are, sure, some missteps.
Yeah.
Danny C, everyone always keeps saying that Bran can see the future, and I never comment or send in emails, but I've been saying for weeks that Bran can't. He says in the finale, I can see what's happened in the past, and I can see what's happening now.
Yeah.
Notice what he left out? I think that's a pretty fair assumption.
Yeah, I mean, we had assumed a lot, or I guess...
I think
it's always
evidence,
been a question,
right?
What he can and can't see, and I think we've always told it as such on the podcast. But yeah, you're right. I think this episode more or less proves that he cannot see the future.
Now,
only
really,
things that are currently or have happened.
Now, what's really going to bend your noodle is that's an intrinsic limit of green sight, or is that because he's relatively inexperienced and untrained?
Mm.
I mean, I just think that, like, if you give a person the ability to see the future, it's game fucking over.
Yeah.
Unless it becomes like the Lord of the Light deal, where it's like, well, it's a different point of view and not sure how to interpret it and all, mm-hmm, that. If it's like just literally like Bran stepping in a 3D Viewmaster and like, oh yeah, here's how we defeat the Night King. Like, how do you fucking beat that?
Yeah.
All right. Cole W. John's speech to Theon was massively important and very interesting. You're a Greyjoy and a Stark, which I believe foreshadows the reveal of John being a Stark and a Targaryen, leading to his eventual reveal to him and how he'll have to make the decision knowing his true self. I think it's a pretty good point.
Yeah, I just don't think he's going to need to make a decision, you know? And as much as he tells Theon,
but
you're both, he's going to be both.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying I think that that's intentional, that Jon has learned all the lessons, and he's, yeah, demonstrated the mastery of those lessons that he's going to need to deal with his own family bullshit that's about to come to light, which is why I don't, yep, buy this whole, oh, it's going to be rough waves in the Danny Jon ocean when they find out he's the rightful king.
Yeah.
Saeed A. The show and the books built Littlefinger to be this cunning, always a step ahead character. Early in the season, when Bran looked at him dead in the eye and said chaos is a ladder, wouldn't that have been his cue to get the fuck out of Winterfell? Yeah, we covered that in the show itself enough, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
The whole Littlefinger should have boned out. All right, stripe eye. Shawnee, in the instant take, you guys talked about the White Walkers and how they must be just a Westerosi thing, but in the World of Ice and Fire, it talks about how in the easternmost part of Essos, the Yi-Ti built 5 forts, and the walls are fused with black stone among 1,000 feet high, housing 10,000 men each, and were built to defend against the Lion of the Night. According to tales told by the priestly scribes of Yin, the Lion of Night, he's reading from the World of Ice and Fire. Mm-hmm. The Lion of the Night fathered a son on the Maiden of Light. This son was the god on Earth who ruled the great empire of the Dawn for 10,000 years before ascending to the heavens.
I can't do it, man.
Yeah.
I can't. I can't invest in another prophecy and another thing from a land so far away from the main action. I just can't do it at this stage of Game of Thrones. I'm sorry.
Right. Long story short is it seems like Essos has their own Long Night that they defended against with a similar wall, which I found... Because the whole reason it started this is when I was doing research in that pod pack.
Yeah.
They did seem to imply that Essos... like, and maybe that's the case. Like, Essos didn't bear the brunt. Mm. Like, the White Walkers eventually were going to move on it, and we're starting to do that before the last hero slash Azor Ahai slash Prince That Was Promised came and sorted his hash out. Mm. But, I skipped the part where they talk about this. This is kind of interesting stuff, though. It also...
Yeah, no, it's totally, like, I'm dismissive because I'm not a lore hound
fine.
Like a lot of people.
That's fine.
But I'm sure tons of people just eat this stuff up.
I think it's weird, though, because, like, George, like, he's got this weird obsession with one-upping himself. He's got this 700-foot hall... high magical wall of ice with 13 the castles building or defending it, and these fucking Yeetis got a 10,000-foot or 1,000-foot obsidian wall with 10,000 fort men garrisoning it, and like, what? Well, Jesus Christ,
could the
now Brandon the Builder seems like he's a hack.
Could the White Walkers even walk over a field of a destroyed obsidian wall?
Oh,
like destroyed dragonglass wall.
You just
like
take
you
the dragon
foot on it and you're done. You're shattered.
Yeah, like the just obsidian caltrops is what you need.
Right, like make this fucking diehard up in here,
and
sprinkle dragon glass everywhere.
Let me ask you this: you have all these dragon glass points sticking up out of the ground.
Uh-huh.
The White Walkers see them, and they reach out and touch them to get them out of the ground. Do they just instantly burst into snow?
I assume so.
Do they have to be penetrated by it, or like just a mere touch of dragon glass?
It's a fine question, but I think. It's worthy of an answer.
You grind up dragon glass into dust, and you load up the dragons with giant pouches that you can drop
you
on, like water. On, yeah, like a crop duster.
Uh-huh.
Does that just, like, fucking... And is that biological warfare for them?
It's gotta be, right?
I mean, I'm joking, but I honestly kind of want to know, like,
yeah.
What is it?
What inventive weapons could they come up with?
Because it doesn't make any fucking sense that you pierce someone with a poisonous substance and they just burst into snow.
Right.
Like, so... Katie bar the door, anything could happen.
Yep.
All right. Andrew B., in one of the final scenes of the finale, we hear Cersei tell Jaime that gold wins wars right before her reveal that the Golden Company is confirmed to be joining the Lannister forces.
Mm.
Could it be possible that Dario and the Second Sons, or perhaps just Dario himself, have joined up with the Golden Company, are sailing to come fight alongside Cersei? Maybe Dario gets word that the Golden Company are headed to Westeros and jumps ship to get a chance to see Dany again. Could it be that he would do this with no intention of fighting for the Lannisters, but then find out about Dany and Jon and side with them anyway? Do you think Dany would feel conflicted about her feelings for Jon if she sees her ex-lover? Love to hear your thoughts.
So many questions.
I think
Dario's done.
If Dario comes over, Dany will not feel conflicted because she said last year that she felt nothing when she dismissed him.
Uh-huh.
That they were just boning. Clearly, right. With John, it's something more. So I don't feel like when her, side dude comes over and says, hey, remember me.
Yeah.
Plus, like, Dario Nyquilus, boring-ass, bearded Dario. Like, if his Eurotrash version Dario we're talking about, maybe. But boring-ass, bearded, good-haired Dario can get the fuck out of here. He didn't rock anybody's socks.
Nope.
Not the way Kit and his Buns of Steel did. I just don't see it. I think Dario's done. He's now the better question is when does Dario, when he gets the Essos times and he sees that Dany and Jon are married,
mm-hmm.
at what point he's just like, you know what? Fuck this Marinese governor bullshit. I'm out.
I mean, he knows she's there to do, right? Like she essentially said, I can't take you with me because I got to marry people.
Yeah.
So that's on him.
Yeah.
If he gets upset about that, he knew that. The score.
Just saying, like, I don't believe that guy's going to be. He's a Rolling Stone, man.
Yeah,
he's gonna like.
I can't believe she left him in charge over there.
I know it seems very irresponsible.
She's gonna come back, and it's gonna be like, what slave? There's 9 slave cities now.
Yeah,
there were only 3 when I left.
Yeah, I wonder because that's the thing. Like, someone needs to rule Essos. Like, this might be like a one world government kind of thing where she's
She makes Varys the head of Meereen, and Tyrion is leading up Carth, and who knows? Okay. There's got to be something for them to do.
Yeah.
Being hand of the world maybe is good enough. I don't know. All right, Ethan S., with Jaime leaving King's Landing as a lone lion, do you think it's possible his next destination is to the cells of Riverrun? He clearly believes in the threat of the White Walkers and intends to fulfill his vow in some way.
Get Edmure.
As he develops some semblance of a rapport with Edmure during the Blackfish Revolt, do you think it's possible he frees him to gather the houses of Riverrun for the fight against the dead?
I don't know. Does he know about Riverrun? Like, Riverrun hasn't even been mentioned.
I mean, that's the crazy thing is that... I mean, if they were going to bring this up, it would have been when Arya upends the Freys. Like, yeah. She could rescue her uncle. And it is, that's the thing that keeps bothering me, is that this is the sloppy shit. Like, Dragonstone being completely deserted. Riverrun being essentially freed from the domain of the Freys. And there's this power vacuum. And Edmure, we know, is alive and unjustly a prisoner. And that's never mentioned.
Yeah, it's that attention to detail.
Those are more. I mean, I don't think Riverrun's got a lot of soldiers at this point, but that's more for the Army of the Living, and it's just going to be. I'm sure if George gets off his ass and writes the book, there'll be a chapter or two about he'd be the young fish. The POV chapter, the young fish, and it's all about Edmure wasting away in the dungeons, and Arya comes in with a Valyrian steel blade clenched between her teeth and is like, time to get out and play, uncle, and. I don't know. I'm writing fan fiction again. Stop me. Every time I do that, just say, shut the fuck up.
Sit down, you're on.
No one read. Yeah, exactly. Or leave.
Yeah.
Elliot S., dragons. I think it might make sense now why dragons have riders. A dragon with no rider doesn't think in terms of dodging, but a competent rider can protect the dragon by being aware of and avoiding ice spears, scorpion bolts, etc. Mm. Hopefully Dany realizes this and does not send her other dragon into battle without a rider.
I just hope they play Danger Zone when the dragons battle.
I think this is a good point. Like, if it is possible that if Viserion had a competent rider who could watch the dragon's back, he never gets hit with the spear.
Possible, yeah.
So Dany needs to get Jon up there. The dragon only has two heads now. Jon's got one of them.
Yeah.
Two of them. All right. All right, Cacton D. When watching the last episode while Viserion is taking down a wall and just spewing his blue death beam, all blue eyes, white dragon style, I noticed his cry was distinctly different. To me, it almost seemed like his cry was a more sorrowful or kind of in pain sort of sound. Do you think the Double Ds wanted to convey that since dragons are magical, there might be something of Viserion still in there, thus giving Bran a better opportunity of connecting with him and warging into him? Or maybe the simple idea of something so magical and wondrous being corrupt is a sorrowful thing in itself. What do you think, Jim?
I don't know why they went for a different cry, other than this is an undead beast now. I really didn't think they were getting at anything other than that.
It did seem a little more tortured.
Yeah.
And also the fact that he's got his wings tattered already, and he's super fast. He's got this invincible mat. I think that's the thing, like with Jim, is like there's definitely something they're doing here, but is it just... to make us feel extra bad about what's happening? Is it to suggest that Viserion's still in there and he's fighting it somehow? I mean, those are not bad things to speculate on, but I don't think there's enough information to say one way or another.
Yeah.
And also, the other question is, does Bran need something to be home to warg into it? Like, I would like to see evidence that Bran can even warg into a white, who I see as mindless.
Yeah.
Like, without their White Walkers directly controlling them, they seem like they don't have... Well, I guess the one in King's Landing has the standing order to kill everything, kill all flesh. Just all flesh must be consumed kind of prime directive. All right, let's move on. This is the final email. Mike D. says, I keep hearing the comment from critics of the pacing that they're running out of time to tell the rest of their story. Assuming the last six episodes are all the rumored 90 minutes, they have 9 hours left. Just for perspective... The entire original trilogy of Star Wars took 6.2 hours. The Godfather took 3 hours and covers 10 years. There Will Be Blood was 2 hours and 38 minutes and covers near 30 years. I think it's pretty doable to tell the rest of this story. Armies can move from battle to battle just by saying it will take a fortnight to march to blank, and the next scene we see them arrive or whatever. Or not, just have them arrive.
Right.
The War of the Five Kings had months to go by and a few episodes, so fear not, with careful planning, this can all be done. I broadly agree.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now, the rumored 90 minutes, that's the thing.
If it's six, if it's like five 60-minute episodes and 190, then but still, like you said, like that's enough to tell 2.5 Godfathers worth of story, and that's a lot of story.
It's a lot of story. Yeah.
Michael had a hell of a lot more than just two threats to worry about and his settling all family business. So, yeah, I think that's the other thing I guess that impressed me about the finale is I, for the first time, see them rounding into a shape where six episodes to go would just about do it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's three probably epic battles. And it can't be just the good guys win. There's got to be, like, some desperate fighting. There's got to be a reversal of fortune. They've got to then fight back from that, and then they got to deal with Cersei.
Right. It's almost like a three-act story within itself, right?
Exactly. And that's
the story is just beginning about the battle for Westeros.
And that's the thing about Game of Thrones that I've always appreciated is that all of the seasons, they may take their sweet time to get there, but they all kind of have that because they're structured after the book, and George Martin is no fool either. You know, he's been a screenwriter and an author for a long time. They all kind of have these individual arcs, except for like Dance and Feast, or Feast and Dance. That's the one thing where George kind of broke down because he's in the middle of a story that he's not quite sure how he wants to tell, I guess. But yeah. I don't know. I feel like I have, after everything's said and done, I have faith. I feel like this was the hard part, right? Because there's nothing but downhill here. Like, everything naturally will flow from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, they've...
All the characters have met. That was a huge intellectual challenge to, like, what would bring these people together to actually talk about this thing?
Yeah, it's a hurdle that... You know, they kicked over as they sort of jumped over it, but kept running.
Yep.
You know, it didn't knock them
definitely
on their face.
Definitely penalized them a little bit on their time, but
yeah.
they finished the race. And
right.
I think,
and now there are no more hurdles. We're just staring at the finish line.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
basically.
Breaking down the wall was huge. Like, there's a lot. There's nothing really stopping this thing from concluding in a satisfying way, I don't think.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I've seen the end state.
Right. My perspective going into this final season is sort of like, I kind of feel like I know what we're going to get, which is this race to the finish. But if they throw in anything extra, I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Exactly.
But I'm not like, I don't need it to feel complete.
And another thing to hang your hat on if you're hoping as a Game of Thrones fan is they have twice the time to develop this last bit correctly.
Yeah.
So I feel like that if you gave the Double D's twice as much time, the execution is going to be even better and the writing is going to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know this for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me if this extra long going away time is a direct result of the Double D's themselves being, because that even came in the official materials. Like, several times I heard them saying, struggle with coming up with a way to make this believable.
Yeah.
And this is what we came up with. Like, it wasn't like... You know, it's very
sort
distinct
like
from
know.
In previous, like, when they're like, oh, man, we've been waiting to tell the Red story for this long. And, oh, man,
yeah.
Like, oh, when we knew people would... Like, they're just largely winging this stuff, man. Like, I feel like the bullet points they got to go off were very similar to the leaked bullet points.
Right.
And now they have to make that good
and
do the best job they can.
Yeah.
So, again, we'll be back Friday with the full spoiler treatment. Next week, we will have a wrap-up podcast, maybe a separate spoiler podcast. Maybe it'll be combined with some intro. Like, it just depends on how our schedule goes next week.
Yep.
And then the week after that, we start back in season two, which I have very fond memories of.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite character, Tyrion. Season two is peak Tyrion, right?
It is, and it has one of the best, I don't know, some of the best stuff, the best conclusion in my mind. That Blackwater stuff.
Yeah, Tyrion just
is
fucking
awesome.
People over left and right. He's slapping, getting back to his season one Joffrey slapping roots.
Yep. You're right. You're right.
It's all good stuff. All good stuff until Tywin comes back and ruins his fun.
Yeah, so join us for that here in a couple weeks.
Yep. So lots of good Game of Thrones to look forward to. And another couple of rounds of feedback. Send it in to GameofThrones@baldmove.com. Of course, there's the forums, forums.baldmove.com, where you can discuss and theorize with your fellow fans. And for once... We're all on the same page again. We can all theorize, and no one's right, and no one's wrong, and no one's cheating. So that's going to be fun for the next couple of weeks. And also social media, all the relevant social media @or/baldmove. You can find us there if you want to stay up with the latest.
And enjoy the outro song here by Blade Gear. We're going to put a link in the show notes, but if you want to find his SoundCloud page, it's soundcloud.com/Blade Gear.
There you go. He'll put a boot in your ass. It's the Westerosi way.
Yeah.
We're out.
Bye.
All right, then.
Tell me whose idea it was to put you in Game of Thrones. I don't want to sound negative, but you made the internet grow. Hands of gold, but then the close-ups and the dialogue, so many eyes roll. Oh, 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 the chemical is taking me out of the sea. Looking for the Cameron Lannister, always worse than burning Cherie. Just another cat. Pop star trying to do fantasy. When will you people see? The only one to do it right was Bowie.
You didn't have to quit Twitter. It's all right, man. We forgive you. You know, just stay the fuck out of Westeros.
Oh, the chemical is taking me out of the sea. Forgive me for this crime, but I need to break the rhyme. It was worse.